Iraq's environment minister says radioactive wreckage and tens of millions of landmines still blight Iraq after decades of war and the deadly violence that engulfed the nation after the U.S. invasion in 2003. Narmeen Othman Hassan says a lack of funding in Iraq's fragile security situation is hampering efforts to clean up contaminated sites across the country. She told Agence France-Presse that only a fraction of tanks and other wartime vehicles contaminated with depleted uranium have been successfully treated and disposed of by the Iraqi authorities. It is a legacy of decades of conflict, the U.S.-sponsored war with Iran between 1980 and 1988, the U.S. Gulf War in 1991, and the 2003 U.S.-led invasion of Iraq and its bloody aftermath. Depleted uranium, a radioactive metal present in armor-piercing bullets used by U.S.-led forces during the 1991 Gulf War and the 2003 invasion, has been blamed for health problems from cancer to birth defects, but much research remains inconclusive. We have 25 million mines in Iraq, one quarter of the world's mines.
The limits of debate in this country are established before the debate even begins, and everyone else is marginalized or made to seem either to be communist or some sort of disloyal person. They've made that something that should not be even entertained for a minute, that powerful people might get together and have a plan. Doesn't happen. You're a kook. You're a conspiracy buff. The only way you cure that, death, bloodshed. I don't advocate it, but I see that it's really the only way.
This week in radical history for the week starting August 31st.
There is something going on in the ether.
The kids are now moving back into the street.
For every Martin they cut down, there must be 100 Martins to step into his shoes. Hey!
This week in radical history for August 31st, 1836, U.S. Marines again invade Peru to protect American interests.
The U.S. government has done some bad things over the years and will almost certainly continue to do them in the years ahead. Foreign policy has very little to do with morality. And as long as any action can be justified by explaining that it was performed in the national interest, that will continue to be the case.
On this date in 1925, Haiti, U.S. Marines and 11-year occupation, the freedom-loving democracy dictatorship they leave in place, continues to pillage and murder Haitians for another 60 years, ending what was once called the wealthiest country in the Western Hemisphere.
And so we give support to repressive governments in South Korea and Brazil and Chile because it is in our national interest to do so. We will supply sophisticated weapons to backward countries and betray an entire people like the Kurds, all because it is in our national interest. What may be difficult to accept is that there's nothing new about that. In fact, it's what we hire our Secretary of State and our Foreign Service to do for us. The myth is that since the First World War, we were ever able to conduct our foreign policy any other way. The United States is a superpower with enormous and divergent interests that it is committed to protect. And at best it is naive, at worst hypocritical, that they don't understand what's involved in that harsh reality. I'm Ted Koppel in New York.
My two more items for 1958, Fidel Castro and Che Guevara and the ragtag rebel army begins a walk into the woods, and they will return and start the destruction of the U.S.-supported mafia-controlled dictatorship in Cuba. Lastly, in 1970, Philadelphia police raid offices of local Black Panther Party. Among those arrested were young teen Wesley Cook, later known as Mahmoud Al-Jamal. Mahmoud was the targeted victim of the FBI's infamous and corrupt COINTELPRO program and is now in death row after a highly prejudicial trial. One of his appeal judges, for example, is one of his original prosecutors, and justice for all. In radical history for September 1st, 1921, the Battle of Blair Mountain was the largest organized armed uprising in America labor history and led directly to the labor laws currently in effect in the United States of America. In a traditional fashion, President Harding would order federal troops in and they would drop bombs from planes to end the strike. Also on September 1st, 1939, Germany invades Poland, start of World War II. To quote Hermann Hesse, "Of course the soldiers who die in the war are worthy of our deepest sympathy. Many of them did great things and suffered greatly, and in the end they paid with their lives. But that does not make them heroes. The common soldier, at whom an officer bellows as he would a dog, is not suddenly transformed into a hero by a bullet that kills him. To suppose that there can be millions of heroes is, of course, itself an absurdity. The obedient, well-behaved citizen who does his or her duty is not a hero. Only an individual who has fashioned his or her self-will, their noble, natural inner law, into their destiny can be a hero. Hermann Hesse. Lastly, for September 1st, 1987, protesting American arms shipments to the Contras by blocking military trains, San Francisco activist S. Brian Wilson loses both legs below the knees when the train fails to stop. Now that's a hero. This Week in Radical History for September 2nd, 1872. The Hague Congress of the First International is held. It is here that Marx and Engels determined it is better to kill the International than allow the growing anti-authoritarian influence to gain control. Under the thumb of Karl Marx, the Congress confirms the principal resolution of the London Conference and takes to task the anarchists and their, quote, divisive, unquote, activities, i.e. anti-authoritarian activities. It expelled the representatives, including Mikhail Bakunin, from the International on the 7th. Items for September 2nd, 1981, UN Human Rights Commission rules that Canadian Indian Act violates international human rights. The problem of the First Nation tribes in Canada and the gross violation of human rights and treaties throughout Canada fight on to this day. Also in 1993, San Francisco mayor starts arresting Food Not Bombs volunteers at their crime, feeding the homeless. This Week in Radical History for September 3rd, 1860, William Walker, a U.S. citizen who once set himself up as dictator of Nicaragua, invades Honduras with his own private army. Once he arrives, he reestablishes slavery. Also on September 3, 1897, Emma Goldman begins lecture tour in Providence, Rhode Island, and speaks at two open-air meetings attended by thousands. The then-mayor warns Goldman that she'll be arrested if she speaks at open-air meeting again. Despite the prohibition, Emma continues to lecture. Speaking of Red Emma, 12 years later in 1909, the mayor of Burlington, Vermont, prevents Emma Goldman from speaking anywhere in his city. Accompanied by Ben Reitman, Emma is attempting to exercise her supposed free speech rights in a short lecture tour in Massachusetts, Vermont, Rhode Island, and is harassed nonstop everywhere she goes. Also on September 3, 1915, Australia, Wobbly Tom Barker is arrested for his anti-war poster, quote, "Workers, follow your masters, stay at home," unquote. Anti-recruiting efforts finally get him 12 months of hard labor, but he quickly released within 3 months following a series of fires in stores and factories. No cause and effect there at all. Also on this date in 1954, the Espionage and Sabotage Act authorizes the death penalty for peacetime sabotage. Also, Congress passes a bill to revoke the citizenships of persons convicted of conspiracy to overthrow the government. These laws that are so loosely worded that governmental abuse of this law abounds. Also on September 3, 1974, former Nixon attorney John Dean enters prisons for the Watergate crimes. Now he's a criminal attorney, proving once again that once you're in the team, you'll do fine, like criminals such as Ollie North or war criminal Henry Kissinger. Do the crime and you'll do just fine. Also on this date in 1991, 25 workers die in a fire at the Imperial Food Processing Plant, Hamlet, North Carolina. 19 were single mothers. A non-union plant, it had not been inspected by the federal or state agencies for 11 years. Despite 3 minor fires earlier in the year and other obvious dangers, the fire exits remained locked. One of the worst disasters of its kind, reminiscent of the Triangle Garment Factory fire in the early 1900s. Also on this date in 2001, South Africa, U.S. and Israel walk out of U.N. conference on racism. Of course they would. Lastly, for September 3, 2003, thousands log on to blow up a virtual bush. This online game, pitting defecating peace doves, the player, against American President George W. Bush, is attracting thousands of play a day, including American government departments. launched last week by the South African student website Get a Life. Quote, "We're able to monitor where the hits are coming from," says Andy Hadfield of Get a Life. He adds, "The game is very popular in Germany, England, South Africa, and France. You win when Bush explodes into a nuclear mushroom, or lose when Rumsfeld's missiles hit your pooping doves once too often."
This is your Radio Roots reporter, Arturo Contreras. On this day, September 4th, in 1781, a group of 46 settlers founded the city of Los Angeles, 12 years after the Spanish began their conquest and occupation of California. 40 years later, Mexico took control of the city after having gained their independence from Spain, 25 years after it was snatched up by the United States in their quest for manifest destiny. The American city of Los Angeles later became the setting for events such as the exclusion and internment of Japanese American citizens, the Watts riots, the mass criminalization of people of color, intense gang violence, and the destructive crack epidemic. I wonder how things might have been had Spain and Europe stayed on their side of the Atlantic. Yeah, I said it. This is your free speech educator reminding you, never let the past slip away.
This week in Radical History for September 4th, 1886, legendary Apache surrenders to General Nelson Miles at Skeleton Canyon, Arizona, ending the last major U.S.-Indian conflict. Geronimo led a small band of men, women, and children out of a forced internment camp on the San Carlos Reservation, successfully evading thousands of U.S. and Mexican troops over the next 18 months in the Southwest Wilderness. Also on September 4th, 1903, Cripple Creek, Colorado, where mine owners are trying to bust a labor union, as police and deputy sheriffs are relieved their duties and all citizens are required to register their firearms, as Governor Peabody sends in the militia. Then in 1904, they seize a local sympathetic newspaper and round up strikers into bullpens and take them to the Kansas border and abandon them. General Sherman Bell of the Colorado National Guard shouted, "Habeas corpus, hell, we'll give them postmortems." This week in Radical History for September 5th, 1877, Great Sioux warrior Crazy Horse is murdered. Crazy Horse and his starving people had peacefully surrendered to U.S. Army on May 6th. Crazy Horse was assassinated on orders of a local reservation agent, bayoneted in the back by U.S. soldiers while in custody at Fort Robinson, Nebraska. Also on September 5th, 1882, first American Labor Day observed, 30,000 workers march in parade sponsored by the New York City Central Labor Union. Also on that date in 1911, pupils desert the classroom and parade in the streets after a Lily boy is punished for passing around a note urging his friends to strike against corporal punishment. In the next fortnight, schools in over 60 major towns and cities will come out in solidarity.
The kids are now moving back into the street.
Also on that date in 1917, the Palmer Raids begin. Federal agents attack Industrial Workers of the World, IWW halls and offices in 48 cities across the nation. Federal agents conduct coordinated raids, seizing records, destroying equipment and books, arresting hundreds of wildly activists for the crime of labor organizing and, quote, obstructing, unquote, World War I. This is done without warrants and with total disregard for civil liberties and legal rights. In December of 1919, the Palmer agents gathered 249 people of Russian origin, including well-known radical leaders such as Emma Goldman and Alexander Berkman, and placed them on a ship bound for the Soviet Union. During one of the raids, more than 4,000 individuals were rounded up in a single night. All foreign aliens caught were deported, with no requirement that there be any evidence against them under the provision of the Anarchist Act. All in all, by January of 1920, Palmer and Hoover had organized the largest mass arrest in U.S. history, rounding up at least 10,000 individuals. Two more items for September 5th, 1989. George Bush I announces a $7.9 billion anti-drug plan. George uses a bag of crack purchased across the street from the White House as a prop to show how ubiquitous drugs are. Later, it was revealed that a DEA agent had to lure a drug dealer there. Why he didn't score the crack from his drug-using son, George II, is unknown. Lastly, for September 5th, 2005, Common Ground Collective offers solidarity, not charity, to survivors of the Hurricane Katrina in New Orleans. They are the first and for a long time the only aid group in the devastated New Orleans area and harassed by cops for weeks.
I went down to New Orleans with some residents and activists of that devastated area. I plugged into the Common Ground Collective.
Of all the problems of racism and classism that were existing down here before, what happened down here was whole series of human rights violations against people of the Gulf Coast perpetrated by the city, state, local government in conjunction with many national based and international based relief organizations.
That lack of organization from the government and what they're kind of where they're falling through, what you've seen where they fall through at.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, This Week in Palestine.
Good morning. It's This Week in Palestine, a weekly presentation of news and views from the Palestinian perspective, a perspective sadly lacking in the mainstream media. This Week in Palestine is committed to bringing you the fact-based Palestinian narrative, which needs exposure if we are to challenge the myths and falsehoods of the Israeli narrative that so dominates Western news. This Week in Palestine was originated by Sharif Fan and is continued in his memory as a weekly feature of Truth and Justice Radio. This is your host, John Roberts. We begin this week asking the question, why is there no reconstruction taking place in Gaza over a year after the most recent assault by Israel? International money has been pledged for reconstruction, but virtually none has taken place. Ali Abu Nima addresses the issue in an article in the Electronic Intifada. He writes, until this summer, not a single one of the homes totally destroyed during Israel's assault on Gaza last year has been rebuilt. Why? The Israeli rights group Gisha, which monitors Israel's siege of Gaza, tries to provide answers in a recent analysis. Where's the housing boom? The 51-day assault last summer destroyed or rendered uninhabitable 19,000 homes. More than 100,000 were damaged, and more than 100,000 people in Gaza remain without permanent shelter. A major reason for the fact that reconstruction is only just beginning is that between last August's ceasefire and the end of July this year, Israel has allowed into Gaza just 6.5% of the reconstruction supplies needed to repair years of destruction and accumulated housing needs. But the story is more complex than that. A basic fact is that Israel still tightly regulates what comes in and out of Gaza, home to 1.8 million Palestinians. Starting in June 2007, Israel has totally banned or severely restricted the entry of construction materials to Gaza. Since that time, Israel waged three devastating wars on the territory. In 2008, 2009, 2012, and the more destructive yet, 2014. The ban is implemented under the pretext that construction materials are dual use. They can be used for military purposes, such as building tunnels, as well as for civilian need. Palestinian resistance fighters use such tunnels only to attack legitimate military targets, according to the recently published independent inquiry commissioned by the UN Human Rights Council into the last Gaza war. Israel, the occupying power in Gaza, however, does not recognize any Palestinian right to resistance or self-defense. The Israeli ban and Egypt's closure of underground supply tunnels under its frontier with Gaza led to an almost total collapse of Gaza's construction sector and helped push unemployment from an already staggering 28% in mid-2013 to 42% today. Gisa says it continues to object to the definition of a basic civilian commodity such as construction materials, as dual use, thus paving the way for blanket bans, especially when considering the fact that the ban was not proven effective in preventing tunnel building. After last summer's Israeli assault, Geisha notes, Israel's security establishment announced Israel would now allow construction materials to enter Gaza for the private sector for the purpose of reconstruction. With Israeli and Palestinian Authority complicity, the UN put in place the so-called Gaza Reconstruction Mechanism, GRM. This complicated system of surveillance and Israeli pre-approval would give the occupation authorities even more intrusive control over the lives of Palestinians in Gaza, who will be subjected to onerous ongoing monitoring as they try to rebuild their houses, communities, and lives following Israel's summer massacre. Palestinians denounce the Gaza Reconstruction Mechanism as a means to give international cover and legitimacy to Israel's siege. It is inevitable that a complicated mechanism such as the GRM should slow down reconstruction efforts and increase costs, Geisha now states. The question is what purpose it serves, if any. Geisha is the group that uncovered the Israeli Defense Ministry's notorious Red Lines document, which established mathematical formulas for how many calories every man, woman, and child in Gaza would be permitted to consume to keep them just at the level of survival. Geisha compares the Israeli-controlled rationing of building supplies to the Red Lines formula, albeit with a security rationale. It is meant to prevent construction materials from being used for building tunnels, Geisha says. But it turns out that the controlled shortage created by the formula is one of the causes for the emergence of a black market for construction materials, as the army itself admits. The fact is that people whose houses have been destroyed often face multiple severe needs, especially given the generally catastrophic economic situation in Gaza. As a result, many will sell the limited materials they are allocated under the Gaza Reconstruction Mechanism. For those who want to build, the process is difficult and expensive. Geisha's report provides a taste. A contractor whose building project in Gaza was approved by Israel told Geisha that he had to provide Israel with the location of the building owner's ID card, the building plans, and the amount of construction materials required. The contractor said it took 4 months for the project to be approved, and he decided to invest elsewhere in the meantime. Another contractor told Geisha that each of the elements involved in the project requires Israeli approval. The process is very complicated, he said. You need warehouses and supervision. These days, everything is restricted, and not all the companies received Israel's approval to work. If a project like this used to take me 3 or 4 months, now it would take about 7 months, and so I have to keep workers on for longer and spend more money than I would have before on a similar project. Another contractor told Geisha about the risks involved even for a determined builder. To build, I'd need to hire people and sign contracts with workers and with other companies. It's not worth my while because I can't be sure my project is going to get approved. And until it does, I lose money because I have to pay the workers I signed on. Even if his project is approved, the contractor said shortages of cement could then produce further delays and costs. Geisha notes that projects run by Qatar and major international agencies are the only ones that are currently proceeding at any scale because they have the resources to navigate the bureaucratic process. But for the private sector and individuals who don't have the resources to navigate the bureaucracy and absorb its extra costs and delays, the Gaza reconstruction mechanism seems more hurdle than help. Geisha acknowledges the arguments of those who assert that without the Gaza reconstruction mechanism, things would be even worse as nothing at all would be coming in. The argument goes that the mechanism sought to achieve a balance between the urgent, vital need for reconstruction in Gaza and the drive to prevent construction materials from reaching hostile entities there. But Geisha's conclusion is rather more sober. What it mostly achieved was to prove once again to what extent Israel exercises control over civilian life in Gaza while largely disavowing responsibility. This combination harms beleaguered population. A year later, the paradigm has to shift, and restrictions on the entrance of construction materials, which serve no one, must be removed, the group concludes. That was an article written by Ali Abunima in the Electronic Intifada. And now on to our feature presentation. This week we go back to featuring voices from the incredibly impressive conference on the Israeli lobby held in Washington, D.C. in April of 2015. Exposing the inordinate power of the Israeli lobby is crucial to challenging its powerful influence over the United States government. This week we will hear presentations from Miko Peled, an Israeli now living in the United States who authored the book The General's Son, and Gideon Levy, a journalist with the Israeli newspaper Aretz. Both have incredible credentials to be the profound critics of Israeli society that they are today. We begin the presentations in progress with more informative introductions.
So the book describes Peled's family's history since his grandparents immigrated to Palestine in the early 20th century. His maternal grandfather was a signer of the Israeli Declaration of Independence. His father, Matti, was a general in the Israeli army. Check out Miko's blog, Tear Down the Wall, at mikopeled.com. And please come, and we can't wait to hear what you have to say. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you all for being here. It's a real honor to speak here and to be with all you wonderful people here, to be on this excellent panel with Gideon and Hoida, I believe, is coming too. I see that Congressman Paul Findlay joined us, so it's nice to see you, Congressman, once again. Yeah, let's give him a hand. And many friends and other activists and people who are really crucial to the issue of Palestine and to the understanding of the issue of Palestine, and of course the Washington Report that's been vital in providing real-time, real information about this issue. So the question that was posed to me, it was, is the lobby good for Israel? And my reply would be, or I would answer this with an unequivocal yes. Those of you who have read their book, Mersheimer and Walt, argue that no lobby has managed to divert U.S. policy, U.S. foreign policy, as far from what American national interests would otherwise suggest, while simultaneously convincing Americans that U.S. and Israeli interests are essentially identical. They continue to say AIPAC's success is due to its ability to reward legislators and congressional candidates who support its agenda, and to punish those who challenge it. AIPAC makes sure that its friends get strong financial support from the myriad pro-Israeli PACs. Those seen as hostile to Israel, on the other hand, can be sure that AIPAC will direct campaign contributions to their opponents. The bottom line is that AIPAC, which is a de facto agent of a foreign government, has a stranglehold on the U.S. Congress. Open debate about U.S. policy towards Israel does not occur there, even though that policy has important consequences for the entire world. One could really end the discussion here, probably, with this, with that statement on its own. But I think it deserves this issue deserves a lengthier discussion. I think that AIPAC and the State of Israel, which benefits from AIPAC's work, owe much of its success to its predecessors, a group of Zionist diplomats who began as early as the turn of the last century and by the 1920s were already traveling extensively around the world, lobbying for the Zionist project and for the funding and implementation of the project, basically the project being the colonization of Palestine by European Jews. Without the huge efforts and diplomatic talent of these people, who included Chaim Weizmann, Moshe Sharet, my own grandfather, Avram Katznelson, later on Abba Ibn and Golda Meir, to name but a few, without these people and their work, Zionism could not have enjoyed the success it had in the years leading up to the Zionist occupation of Palestine and the establishment of the State of Israel. The lobbying by the early Zionist diplomats, all of whom, by the way, were well-spoken, highly educated, completely secular, they were all white Europeans and looked nothing like traditional Jews that the world was accustomed to seeing, their work paved the way to AIPAC and its tentacles here in the U.S. and in other countries in the West where Zionists needed support. In order to appreciate AIPAC's enormous contribution to Israel, I think we need to do two things. We need to understand what this organization is ultimately selling and understand its strategy. The key to Israel's legitimacy is the Zionist narrative. And AIPAC is selling the narrative in order to maintain the legitimacy. The Zionist narrative in this country is not only accepted, it is treated with religious fervor. It is seen as biblical and indisputable. One does not need to convince Americans that Israel is always right and that the Zionist narrative is true because they receive this with their mother's milk, quite literally. And what is this narrative? It is a mythical story that turned the history of Palestine from 1947 until the present time on its head. The brutal ethnic cleansing of Palestine, the establishment of a racist apartheid state which offers exclusive rights to Jewish people in Palestine, was sold here as a story of heroism and revival. Thanks to AIPAC, the horrific, brutal destruction of Palestine from 1947 to the present day is virtually unknown in this country. That in itself is an impressive accomplishment without which Israel could not have survived. And there is no better proof of that success than the reaction here in the U.S. to the 51-day massacre of innocents in Gaza that took place in the summer of 2014. More than 2,000 people were murdered in cold blood in Gaza on prime time, if we may safely say that there was a consensus in this country that this massacre was not only acceptable and justifiable, but necessary as a means of self-defense. To achieve this is nothing short of magic, and AIPAC was able to pull this through. When Israel, through AIPAC and the countless organizations that work with it and through it, talks about a threat to Israeli security, they mean a threat to the narrative. Since the early 1950s, Israel has been claiming that Palestinians in the Gaza Strip pose a threat to its security, indeed, to its very existence. The Israeli army has been attacking in Gaza and exacting a heavy toll on civilians in Gaza for nearly seven decades. Yet, surprisingly, there has never been a tank, a fighter jet, or a regular military remotely capable of threatening the State of Israel. Why then do we hear so much about a security threat when now, as in the past, the Gaza Strip is made up of mostly poor refugees? It is the narrative. The existence of over 1 million refugees in Gaza, the majority of whom are under 18 years of age, is a threat to the narrative and therefore a threat to the legitimacy of the State of Israel. And therein lies the threat to Israeli existence. AIPAC has been able to successfully sell the myth of the existential threat to the American public. We constantly hear about the threats to Israeli existence, though clearly there has never been one. The threat of Gaza, the threat of Palestinians everywhere, the threat of Iraq, the threat of Iran, the threat of SJP, as we heard earlier, are all fabricated in order to allow Israel to maintain its brutal hold on Palestine and its people and to receive foreign aid, though clearly, as a developed state, it does not need and should not qualify for it. The myth of Israel as a democracy has no factual basis, yet it too has become an indisputable fact. Israel has from the very beginning defined itself as a racist apartheid state that prefers Jews. No attempt has been made to hide this fact, and for almost seven decades, Israeli lawmakers have made it their business to develop the state for the Jewish population at the expense of the Palestinian population, be they citizens, residents, or simply people living without any legal definition at all. Palestinians have been pushed out of every aspect of the life of the state from the very beginning, not to mention the fact that they were pushed out of the country and not allowed to return. The web of laws that govern the lives of Palestinians, whether they live in Yaffa, in Haifa, in Jerusalem, in the Negev Desert, in Ramallah, Jenin, or in Khan Yunis, is too complicated to even attempt to understand. Yet regardless of where in Palestine Palestinians reside, they are governed by the State of Israel under laws that are vastly different than the ones that govern the lives of Jewish Israelis. And still we hear that Israel is the only democracy in the Middle East. Israeli occupation of the West Bank, which took place in June of 1967, is sold as though it was the result of an inevitable war, a response to an existential threat at the end of which Israelis prevailed and the territories are the spoils of war. But in fact, the conquest of East Jerusalem, the West Bank, and the Gaza Strip were the final stage of the occupation of Palestine, and all were planned far in advance. The war of 1967 concluded and completed the occupation of Palestine and the creation of a single state over all of Palestine with exclusive rights for Jewish people. What is Jewish about this, as Alice Rothschild asked earlier, I don't know. Most Jewish people don't live there. The majority of the people who do live there are not Jewish, and Israel certainly does not espouse any Jewish values. Yet, we hear that Israel is the Jewish state. None of this could have been achieved without a strong and influential lobby. AIPAC is engaged in convincing Americans that U.S. and Israeli interests are essentially identical, as I mentioned earlier. But there is no need to convince Americans that Israel is right because, like I said earlier, they receive it with their mother's milk. So much so that in cases where the interests of the two countries collide, the demand is always for the U.S. to adjust its policy so as to align with Israeli interests and not the other way around. And we saw this example recently, about a month ago, with Netanyahu's very successful campaign stop here at the Capitol and with the Iran issue. One has to wonder, how is it that a false history is kept alive in the face of clear evidence to its being untrue? Well, you can imagine my surprise when I looked at my son's high school history book. My boys went to school in San Diego. In AP World History book, and found that the entire chapter regarding the ancient Hebrews is taken from the Old Testament. My first reaction was to make sure I was actually looking at a history book. The second reaction was to see if the beginning of the book begins with a story of creation, of the creation, basically teaching creationism, because they may as well have been. In a country where there is a debate still over whether creationism should be taught in school or evolution, the Zionist narrative, which claims its roots in biblical stories of the ancient Hebrews, is taught as history, although little to no historical proof exists to substantiate it. This sort of influence can only be achieved through years and years of hard work, an effort to instill the narrative as a value and not just as an historical episode. This can only be done, again, by a lobby that knows how to influence society. Along this vein, AIPAC and the other Zionist groups, all of whom are in the business of selling the Zionist narrative, engage in community development and service activities that root them well in communities across the country. Validation and acceptance of the Zionist narrative are an integral part of almost all of these efforts, as well as the delegitimization of any Palestinian claims to a legitimate narrative which contradicts the Zionist story. The Zionist narrative is a value that goes hand in hand with democracy, freedom, and tolerance, while the Palestinian narrative is associated with lies, hatred, violence, and bigotry. Today we see serious cracks in the wall that AIPAC was able to build around the issue of Palestine. It has been severely weakened due to the diligence and tremendous work being done, like we heard earlier, on campuses by Students for Justice in Palestine. For the first time, we see a change in the conversation on Palestine, and the level of the debate on this issue has been elevated, again, thanks to SJP. So it would seem that the big bad lobby AIPAC has now finally met its match with Students for Justice in Palestine on campuses. But still, we see plenty of tolerance workshops and initiatives to weed out racism and anti-Semitism, and this was done recently at UCLA, where one of my sons is a junior. And these take place in schools and universities all across the U.S. And within these seemingly benign and positive initiatives, the Zionist narrative and the delegitimization of Palestinians are pursued with vigilance. The persecution of Palestinians in the U.S., which is a crucial element in the survival of the Zionist narrative and the legitimacy of Israel, is also the work of a well-oiled lobby. Nothing, I believe, demonstrates this better than the closure, prosecution, trial, and convictions of the Holy Land Foundation and the five men who operated it. This could not have been achieved without tremendous behind-the-scenes work and years of preparation. It was one of the clearest cases of injustice in the history of America, of the American judicial system, and it has the Israeli lobby fingerprints all over it. The Holy Land Foundation did not engage in terrorist activities, nor did they fund or support terrorism in any way. This was made absolutely clear in their trials. Yet five men were convicted and are currently serving prison sentences of 20 to 65 years in maximum security jails. Why was this necessary? Because a respected, successful, and honest Muslim Palestinian charity is a threat to the narrative and to the legitimacy of the State of Israel. So the Holy Land Foundation, its operators, its major contributors, and an entire community had to be taken down. And though it took almost two decades and two trials, this mission was accomplished. AIPAC's success is due to its ability to reward legislators and congressional candidates who support its agenda and to punish those who challenge it. It starts, in fact, at a much lower level. Members of small and seemingly insignificant city councils, as well as large ones, are invited to junkets, as we all know, to see Israel. Connections to AIPAC are developed very early in a politician's career so that every aspiring politician in the U.S. understands that supporting Israel, even if it means turning a blind eye to terrible crimes, even if it means giving Netanyahu, who stands at the head of a racist, brutal regime and who oversaw the cold-blooded murder of thousands of civilians in Gaza just a few months ago, again, even if it means receiving him with a standing ovation, it is necessary for success in American politics. Maintaining Israel's legitimacy and keeping the narrative alive is key. It is the most important strategic objective for Israel, and therefore it is so for AIPAC. We can clearly say that AIPAC is and always has been not only good, but crucial to the existence of the State of Israel. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much. I just wonder if Israel is so good, if the lobby is so good for Israel, They're losing wonderful Israelis like you. You're living in California. They're moving to Berlin. What's the deal here? Anyway, Gideon Levy, he's going to talk about unconditional support for Israel. Does it endanger Israeli voices? As we all know, Gideon Levy is a columnist for the Israeli daily Haaretz and a member of its editorial board. Levy joined Haaretz in 1982 and spent 4 years as the newspaper's deputy editor. He's the author of the weekly Twilight Zone feature, which covers the Israeli occupation in the West Bank and Gaza over the last 25 years, as well as a writer of political editorials for the newspaper. Our Washington Report readers love it when we reprint his powerful columns in our pages. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I think that Mikko left me two spare minutes, so I'll be longer. Thank you very much for having me here today. Never was I so convinced that Israel and the United States are really sharing the same values after listening to all those fascinating presentations today, because by the end of the day, we are dealing with two regimes which are very, very similar, with two regimes that have very little to do with democracy, and I will get to it. I was born in Tel Aviv. I was brought up in Tel Aviv. I was a very good boy, Tel Aviv. I served in the Israeli army. I did even something which is much worse than this. I worked for 4 years with Shimon Peres, then leader of Israeli opposition in the late 70s, early 80s, before most of you were born. And it was only by the late 80s, when I started to travel to the occupied territories quite accidentally, when I realized, as a journalist, when I realized that the biggest drama of Israel is taking place half an hour away from our homes, in our dark backyard, that this real drama of Israel has almost no one to be interested in, that it is hidden in the backyard of Israel, half an hour away from our homes. All those crimes are taking place, and we Israelis, most of us, if not all of us, do not want to know, do not know, and above all, do not care. And it took me many, many years to understand how come. How come that the society, some of you met Israelis, they are not monsters. Every catastrophe in the world, the Israelis are always the first one to send rescue teams with field hospitals. Many Israelis would help any old lady to cross the road many times, even if she doesn't want to cross the road. People with values. How come that this society lives for so many years with this drama in its backyard and feels so good about itself and has so little moral doubts, if at all? How is it possible? How is it possible that most of the Israelis, if not all of them, are deeply convinced that the IDF is the most moral army in the world? Try to tell an Israeli, and I tried it once or twice, you know what, maybe it's the second moral army in the world. Maybe the army of Luxembourg is more moral. I don't know if Luxembourg has an army at all. They will be deeply offended. How can you dare? How come that when this reality is taking place so close to our homes, not over the oceans, but just half an hour away from our homes, how come that we live in peace with it, that we continue with it, that there is no resistance, almost nothing? And here I want to object to what my friend Mikko said. When I got first the invitation to come here, the first words were Israel lobby. I said, wow, they invite me. AIPAC is inviting me. And then I said, that's the chance of my life. And I'm going to come there to Washington and to tell them, listen, With friends like yours, Israel does not need enemies. But unfortunately, but then I continued to read, and I read that I'm privileged to be invited to another forum, not exactly AIPAC, and even not the Anti-Defamation League. But I can say it from here, Miko. I think that we are dealing with a corrupting friendship. I think that if it wouldn't be the Israel lobby, Israel would have been today a better place to live in. Israel would have been a more just place. And I think that if it wouldn't be the Israel lobby, the United States would have been a better place and a more democratic place. But it's not for me to judge the American politics. And still, by the end of the day, we are dealing with an enigma. Because nothing can really explain it. Nothing can explain how administration after administration, legislators after legislators, are going in the very same way, which contradicts American interest in so many cases, which contradicts international law, human rights, moral values, you name it. Can it be only this small group, as powerful as it is? Is it the full explanation? I doubt it, but that's for you to decide, not for us in Israel. But for us in Israel, it, or at least for me, it is very clear. Think about a relative of yours or a friend of yours who is, God forbid, a drug addict. There are two ways to deal with him. One is to supply him with money and he will go and buy more drugs. He will be very grateful to you. He will appreciate you. He will tell you, you love me, you are my friend, you are my best friend. The other way is to send him to a rehabilitation center. He will be so mad at you. But what is real care? And what is real love? And what is real friendship? And does anyone in this hall have the slightest doubt that Israel is occupation addicted? But, and therefore for me, this conference here is so crucial and so important. Because we have to face reality. And reality is that there is no chance for a change from within the Israeli society. No way. I'll try to explain why. But if this is the case, the only hope is for an international intervention. And the only hope is from this place, from Washington, from the United States, from the EU. Only from there. Because the Israeli society is by far today too brainwashed. Life in Israel is by far too good. And Israel, let's face it, is a society which lives in denial, totally disconnected with reality. Would it be a private person? I would recommend either medications or hospitalization, because people who lose connection with reality might be very dangerous, either to themselves or to society. And the Israeli society lost connection with reality. It lost connection with the reality in its backyard. It's totally lost connection with the international environment. Really, to believe that 5 million Jews know better than 6 billion people of the world? Really believe that 5 million Jews will be able to continue to live on their sword forever? Is there one example in history in which any country lived on its sword forever? Empires? Really believing that in the 21st century it is acceptable to ignore the international law in such a way, to ignore the international institutions, and to rely only on the United States and Micronesia? Let's not forget this friend of Israel. And recently also Czech Republic. Thank you, Czech Republic. And Canada, your neighbor, obviously. Does it work? Has it ever worked? So therefore it is so crucial for people like me to see any kind of change here in the United States. And we jump on any sign. When J Street was established, we say, yeah, here it comes. And it didn't come. When Obama was elected, I had tears in my eyes. I said, here it comes. And it didn't come. And when I see conferences like here today, again, it gives me some hope that change might happen. Because change will have to take place here. In Israel, it's a lost case. Forget about it. The Israeli society had surrounded itself with shields, with walls, not only physical walls, but also mental walls. I don't want to get into it because it's another lecture, but I'll just give the three principles which enable us Israelis to live so easily with this brutal reality. A, most of the Israelis, if not all of them, deeply believe that we are the chosen people. And if we are the chosen people, we have the right to do whatever we want. B, there were more brutal occupations in history. There were even longer occupations in history, even though the Israeli occupation gets to quite a nice record. But there was never in history an occupation in which the occupier presented himself as the victim. Not only the victim, the only victim around. This also enables any Israeli to live in peace because we are the victims. The other day, Professor Falk spoke about this dual strategy of Israel of being a victim on one hand and manipulating the other on the other hand. After what happened in Paris and in Copenhagen with the terror attacks, Benjamin Netanyahu came with the notion all the Jews must come to Israel. It's the safest place for the Jews in the world. It's a shelter for the Jews in the world. Which is wrong because Israel is today the most dangerous place on earth for Jews. But let's put it aside. It was only 24 hours later when he said Israel is an existential threat under the Iranian bomb. And I asked myself, how can you dare call Jews to come and to join this suicidal project when the Iranians are going to bomb us? But in Israel, everything goes, and both declarations were accepted as the only truth. And here I get to the third set of values which enable us Israelis to live in peace with the occupation. And this is maybe the most crucial one and the worst one. We say victimization, we say chosen people. When I say victimization, it goes without saying we have to mention the Holocaust and the unforgettable Mrs. Golda Meir that the American jury had exported to Israel. She said once, this unforgettable woman, that after the Holocaust, the Jews have the right to do whatever they want. But the third set of values is the most dangerous one. And this is the systematic dehumanization of the Palestinians, which enable us Israelis to live in peace with everything. Because if they are not human beings like us, then there is not really a question of human rights. And if you stretch under the skin of almost every Israeli, you will find it there. Almost no one will treat the Palestinians as equal human beings like us. I once wrote that we treat the Palestinians like animals, and I got so many protest letters from animal rights organizations, rightly so. But by the end of the day, how many Israelis did ever try for a moment to put themselves in the place of the Palestinians for a moment, for one day? And I want to give you two examples which will demonstrate it. Many years ago, I interviewed then candidate for Prime Minister, Ehud Barak. And I asked him a question which I try to ask in any occasion. Mr. Barak, what would have happened if you would have been born Palestinian? And Barak gave me then the only honest answer he could give me. He said I would have joined a terror organization. What else would have he done? Would he become a poet? He doesn't know to write poems. Would he become a pianist? He's quite a bad pianist, and I doubt if he would have become a collaborator, because he is a fighter. And it became a scandal, because how can you dare to put Ehud Barak to think what would have happened if he would have become a Palestinian? And the second incident, briefly, second intifada, the city of Jenin, the most closed city in the West Bank, real total siege. I go out from Jenin, I come to the checkpoint, a Palestinian ambulance is parking there with the red lights. I stand after him, no cars can get out of Jenin in those days, no cars can get in, and I wait. The soldiers are playing Begamon in the tent. Usually I know myself, it's better that I don't get into confrontation with the soldiers because it always ends up very badly. So I stayed in the car. But after 40 minutes, I couldn't take it, and I went out to the car, from the car. I went first to the Palestinian ambulance driver and asked him, what's going on? He told me that's the routine. They let me wait 1 hour until they come and check the ambulance. And I couldn't take it anymore, and I went to the soldiers. It became a confrontation, but the question that I asked them, which really brought them to direct their weapons toward me, was one. What would have happened if your father would have been lying in this ambulance? This freaked them out. They lost control. How can I dare to compare between their father and the Palestinian in the ambulance? And this set of beliefs that they are not human beings like us enable us Israelis to live in so much peace with those crimes, ongoing crime for so many years, with losing any kind of humanity, values. I heard today people talk about Jewish values. I must be frank with you, I don't know what are Jewish values. I know what are universal values. Let's not get into it, really. There are very clear universal values. And there is a very, very clear international law. But for most of the Israelis, international law is very important. But not for Israel. Israel is a special case. Why is it a special case? And again, you get with all those set of values, with this living in denial. And here I want to get back to the topic of our panel. Is it good for Israel? No, it's very corrupting. Because as long as the United States enable Israel to continue, obviously the Palestinians are the first and direct, unbelievable victim of it. But by the end of the day, what will Israel be after all those years? What is it already today? Where does it direct to? And things are getting worse and worse. And therefore, I have so little hope about change from within the Israeli society. Because things, as you might know, are going more and more to the nationalistic, militaristic, religious direction, with very little hope that change will come from within. Why would Israelis go for a change? What incentive? Why would they bother? Life is so good. You should have seen Israel in the days when Gaza was bombed, when the beaches were crowded, the helicopters were passing on the way to bomb Gaza. The Israeli TV hardly showed photos from there. Newspapers hardly wrote anything. I wrote one article about the responsibility of the pilots, and I needed to use bodyguards to get out of my home after this. The problem was, by the way, that the bodyguards were settlers, and they argued with me all day long until I saw that I'm much more secure without the bodyguards rather than with them. But the last war in Gaza, and this will be my final remarks, the last war in Gaza taught us also that Israel, which has three regimes today, maybe the only country, the only state in the world with three regimes, one for the Jews, one for the Arab citizens, and one, an apartheid regime in the West Bank and Gaza, one of the most brutal and cruel tyrannies in the world. But even for the facade, even for this democracy, which I always thought is a democracy for its Jewish citizens, I realized last summer that it is a democracy for its Jewish citizens, but only if they think like the majority. And therefore, and by this I want to conclude, I want to tell you all that few of us, very few, much too few, but few of us are looking to the West, Europe, and then United States, with a great hope, because we lost hope in Israel. Thank you very much.
That was Israelis Miko Peled and Gideon Levy speaking at the conference on the Israeli lobby presented at the National Press Club in Washington, D.C.
King-size thrills and breathtaking suspense. See this charge of dynamite, an explosion of terror you will never forget.
Welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show with Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. He led from the front, conducting more raids on the coast of occupied Europe than any other man in World War II. Royal Navy Commander Harold Goulding, DSO, finally gets the recognition he deserves. But why did it take 70 years? Yes, where were we last week enjoying the celebration of the life and World War II exploits of Commander Harold Goulding? But why has it taken those 70 years for his... He was commanding Operation... HMS Northney, which trained the Royal Navy's elite commandos and special forces in Hayling Island. We remembered him last Friday. Also, killing the host. How did we allow a parasitic financial system to grow up around us? Advisor to Greece's Syriza party and author of the book of the same name, Michael Hudson, explains. Also, Kevin Cahill joins us to talk about Microsoft, Google, Facebook, Twitter, YouTube, Skype and Yahoo. Are they just the front end of the US National Security Agency that's using all these as shop windows to hoover up everything about us? Also, why is the Goddard inquiry into VI paedophile child sex abuse and murder using staff from the Home Office, which it's supposed to be investigating? And one airliner that was allowed to leave otherwise closed US airspace on the afternoon of the 9/11 attacks. Who was on it? And where was it heading? We hear from the author of Solving 9/11, Chris Bolin. Plus, it's Martin Summers' chance to take us on a tour of the world's hotspots. But first, I'm joined by Kevin Cahill. Hi, Kevin. Welcome to the Politics Show.
Hi, Tony.
Now, you've come in particularly, I think, today to talk about the NSA. But let's start with some of the revelations that there have been recently about the VIP paedophile scandal. And there's a particularly fascinating article by Leah McGrath Goodman, which is in Newsweek, After years of horrifying revelations, she says, about sexual abuse of children by people of power and influence, Britain has called in a judge from New Zealand in a bid to guarantee the independence of a new inquiry. In an opening statement, she said she will lead a team that will investigate thousands of allegations into abuse perpetrated by people of prominence in public life. But then she goes into question, and she's quoting from many of the survivors, to say, why are staff from the Home Office being used in this inquiry when the Home Office itself is supposed to be under investigation?
Yeah, no, I mean, I don't even begin to understand why none of our own national newspapers have carried this. 70% of the staff for the Goddard inquiry, it turns out, now come from the Home Office, the government ministry that's most likely to be the target of the inquiry.
So what can be done about that?
It's very hard to know what to do. Leah Goodman has discovered a couple of other things. There are crucial papers from the permanent secretary and the Home Secretary's private files that are missing for a crucial, the beginning of the cover-up. The second thing she discovered is there are files in the National Archives of children's homes going back years in the control of the Home Office. They were Home Office children's homes. And these files were shown to nobody. They weren't shown to the Oneless Inquiry, nothing. So into all this come 70% of the staff from the Home Office to conduct an objective inquiry.
Well, it can't possibly be objective, can it? I'm reminded, Martin, of the Operation Gladio inquiry, where the fascist terrorist in Italy, Vincenzo Vintiguerra, says the state cannot find itself guilty.
Well, yes, and of course these kind of questions are being raised here. As I constantly stress, I think that the real thing that people need to focus on here is the use of paedophilia by the intelligence services as a tool for blackmail, which is why it's become so widespread. We're not just talking about people having bizarre proclivities and then being protected. It's a systematic use of paedophilia as a means of blackmailing various political figures.
Kevin, what do you make of that?
No, this takes you to a central a word that's cropping up everywhere, Kinkora.
Yeah.
The reason Kinkora is cropping up is because it's one of the very few homes about which anything is known. But looking at the closed and secret files, the Home Office Children's Homes files in the National Archives, there's 120 of them that were subject to inspection because things were going wrong. So what Martin says, as far as I can see, using disturbed children from children's homes was a policy of MI5. And what they are scared stiff about is that Kinkora is working loose.
What's been the effect, Kevin, do you think, over the years of this, then? If this has, you know, as you both of you are suggesting here, that the VIP paedophiles were being used as kind of political puppets, what's been the effect over the years of this?
The whole of our political life has been corrupted. People like these security and intelligence officials have been able to blackmail elected members of parliament, government ministers. And what the picture we get of our politicians is, you know, elected by the people and having a mandate from the people has been completely destroyed.
Another story that's come out recently, this is actually in July, in The Guardian, in various other outlets, is that the BBC has forced out the team which was behind exposing the Savile story. This is Merrion Jones in The Guardian. He's saying basically BBC journalists will be afraid of speaking out about the next big BBC scandal after seeing how those who tried to expose Jimmy Savile were forced out, according to the former head of investigations at Newsnight. Merrion Jones said the way he and other journalists who complained about the way the BBC had handled the scandal were pressured to leave.
Yeah. I mean, there's a rumour in London that Panorama are underway to undermine the whole paedophile thing.
What do you mean by that?
Well, there is a serious problem with both the allegations and the unfortunate people making them. And certainly amongst those who are interviewing people in London, there's a belief that up to 50% of the allegations may be if not untrue, may not be verifiable. And it's understood that Panorama have launched a program to try and, you know, deflate the whole thing and rubbish it.
Amazing. Among those who Marion Jones says were also targeted by bosses over Savile include his colleague, and my old colleague actually, on the investigation, Liz McKean. She left after 23 years with the corporation in April 2014 and now works on Channel 4's Dispatches, Martin.
Well, if what we suspect is true, that the intelligence services were using children's homes as a means of political blackmail, you can bet your bottom dollar that they're going to be pulling all the stops out to protect themselves. The police this week, when they were investigating Harvey Proctor, he suggested that the person who's accusing Harvey Proctor said that both the head of MI5 and the head of MI6 were involved in abuse of him. Now, that's what the allegations are.
Well, those would be the allegations if you wanted to discredit the whole thing. This is what it's about.
Well, it could be. I mean, one of the ways to try and discredit something like this is to create unbelievable allegations or what have you.
Is this a sort of straw man theory, Kevin?
Yeah. No, the police, the Wiltshire police, did a press conference, which is impolitely known in London circles as the Guilty House press conference. But the police implied or suggested that these were the first allegations against Ted Heath. They weren't. The allegations against Ted Heath were made by identified officers in MI5 in 1974 and circulated by Colin Wallace. Tony Wedgwood Benn made a very, very important speech in 1990 in which he actually identified the documents. Now, I mean, is anybody going to investigate this?
Well, I tell you what, the IPCC are actually already investigating Wiltshire Police over their inadequate investigations into child sexual abuse in Wiltshire in the past, and yet, for some unbelievable, unknown reason, Wiltshire Police has been decided that Wiltshire Police will be spearheading the national investigation into Ted Heath.
Yeah, as I say, they appear to have told journalists, either on the side of that press conference, that these were the first allegations of this kind of thing against Ted Heath. Well, they seem very short on their history, and this may be deliberate, to avoid saying the deputy head of MI5 was the one who started it, Peter Wright. That's now fully documented. It's in Hansard. The Speaker of the House of Commons was given the falsified papers. You know, it's crazy.
So, in other words, what you're suggesting, Kevin, is that this was part of Clockwork Orange to try and undermine Heath. But I think what I take from all of this is the kind of games these people play. And these allegations, whether they're true or false, are part of a game of blackmailing politicians trying to get results to Heath, if he was involved in sexual activity or whether he wasn't, he's a target for blackmail, and that's what we're talking about here.
But then you've got this guy, Peter Heyman, who's the ambassador to Canada, held...
Well, he's deputy head of MI6 as well, wasn't he?
He had a role in relation to 6. Nobody quite knows what it was, but it was high up. Hmm. Something like a deputy director, but nobody's sure.
Well, tell us about him then. What was his relationship to all this? He was ambassador to Canada as well?
Well, he was all sorts of things. He was the deputy head of the Foreign Office. He had access to all the British secrets. And nobody nobody discovered he was a raving paedophile with fantasizing about murdering children.
So, I mean, can the police be trusted to look into this properly, Kevin? I suppose that's what we're asking here, because you've also got the possibility of the police briefing the press wrongly sometimes, in fact also briefing witnesses wrongly about the identity of somebody they're accusing. This can set hairs running and actually really muddy the waters when these investigations actually start to be pursued.
Well, even the Financial Times has rebelled. It had a big article yesterday saying that everybody was getting really disturbed about the way the police are doing the investigation through the media. That's hardly the way you expect a police investigation to be conducted.
Well, what happens is, if someone's been interviewed, then the police won't necessarily do a press release or something, but the media will ask the police, are you interviewing somebody, and then generally they'll confirm it or deny it.
Well, Harvey Proctor has thrown a huge spanner in this because he's effectively said, this is what I was interviewed about. And it's certainly bizarre.
There's also the involvement of Mark Watts and the XRO News website, which I know you're involved in as well, Kevin, in this whole scandal with Harvey Proctor. And when someone comes out and denies all these things, then it's very difficult to know what to think about it, isn't it?
Well, you know, I mean, what can we think? We haven't seen the evidence, so we don't know for sure. But we do know that the people who started this whole thing in 74, the Clockwork Orange project, have never been prosecuted for anything.
This whole business seems to be dragging on and on and on. Isn't that part of the tactics, Martin?
Yes, I mean, the way, if you want something not to happen, you just keep blocking and blocking, don't you? Mm-hmm. Just keep throwing cold water on it and hopes it goes away. I'd like to come back to King Korra, because I think that's a key thing, because I think the evidence there is that MI5 were definitely using it as a place of blackmail. And I think that's accepted across the political spectrum in Northern Ireland, because many of the people blackmailed were loyalist paramilitaries.
And you mentioned Colin Wallace earlier, didn't you? Tell us about him. Who is he?
Well, he was the army press officer in Belfast in 1974, when I was a freelance journalist in Northern Ireland as well as a student. He put out all these smears, particularly about Ted Heath, but about others, Harold Wilson, and so on. And he was trying to undermine the elected government of the time. And he was thrown out of the army, although it looks to be on spurious grounds. And then he was convicted of manslaughter with extremely dodgy evidence.
A lot of this was covered by Paul Foote, wasn't it? He covered a lot of this. But, I mean, I think what people need to take home from this is that, in actual fact, these organisations, intelligence services and the police to some extent, are not to be trusted. They're not to be taken at face value. They do engage in blackmail and they do engage in terrorism.
Take a look at Hillsborough. That inquiry, the final one, was conducted by relatively ordinary people. It was not in the hands of the police or lawyers, and look at the result we got, the truth. I think the whole situation in Northern Ireland from, say, 72 onwards needs to be gone over again.
But who by? Because, I mean, there were people who were raising questions, well, are the police actually up to the job, especially when MI5 are a sort of higher tier, and they're not, they're sort of almost floating above all this, aren't they, the intelligence services, and when something starts going the way they don't like it, then they'll intervene to pervert the course of justice?
Well, I mean, the original Clockwork Orange stuff looked like treason. It was much worse. It was paid servants of the state trying to bring down the government we, the people, had elected.
So tell us a bit more about that. What's the timescale and who was involved?
Okay. In the early 70s, things went badly wrong in Northern Ireland, far wronger than we, the public, ever understood, because the reporting was corrupted by people like Colin Wallace, who engaged in a campaign against the elected government instead of, focusing his attention on the terrorists.
Well, this is around about the time of Bloody Sunday too, wasn't it?
Bloody Sunday was a total catastrophe, but we now know that the gunfire and everything was never ordered. In other words, the Paris went in and just shot without orders. And it was all, it was murder.
Yeah, well, I mean, we're still going over all of this. I think more importantly, to my mind, is the bombings in Dublin and Monaghan in 1972, which killed the largest number of civilians and the largest number of people in any day of the Troubles. And investigations by the Garda in the Republic have definitely pointed the finger at the Glenane gang in County Antrim as working with MI5. And, of course, that was covered by Panorama not long ago. They did one of the best things they've done in ages about all of this.
Yeah. Panorama are getting closer, but they're not there yet, because we're talking about misinformation, and we're talking about, but you've got to the serious stuff now, the bombing of Dublin. Nobody has ever been prosecuted for that, and the names of the suspects are widely known in Northern Ireland, in the Irish Republic, and here.
But, I mean, with this current VI paedophile scandal, Kevin, it's going to take more than a panorama to do something. We've seen a lot of accusations and actually very strong evidence about people who are high up in British society, the Whitehall, Westminster types of paedophilia and murder, but we haven't seen any prosecutions of living people. People like Leon Britton, it seems, you know, we wait until someone dies and then it's revealed that the guy is a paedophile.
This is, yeah.
So what can we do about this? This is a difficult one, but I'm asking you, how do we get over that to actually start to arrest living, powerful paedophiles?
It may sound slightly to one side, but we could start where Leah Goodman started. Get all the files and publish them. No more secret files, no more lost files, no more hidden files. Let me raise another tiny offside point. Parliament was re-elected in May. All the committees are sitting now and running, except one. The Intelligence and Security Commission committee hasn't been formed and hasn't appeared. So, you know, and none of the media have mentioned it.
Sounds like a banana republic. You know, they've decided they can't actually get agreement between the security services, Conservative Party and Labour, so who's going to be on that committee. Also, maybe they're waiting for the new Labour Party. But anyway, they should have an interim committee, Martin. Anyway, what's your thoughts about how we actually start getting arrests and trials of living VI paedophiles?
Well, we've got to rely upon the idea of police independence. Now, the police may, in fact, not be doing their job properly or may be implicated, but that doesn't mean that the police are not the first port of call. I mean, in Northern Ireland, for example, all sides of the community have decided to support the police service of Northern Ireland despite their unhappiness with the previous incarnation as the Royal Ulster Constabulary. And that's the only way forward. If the police aren't doing their job properly, kick them out and put some policemen in there and women in there who do know how to do the job properly.
Getting bigger by being better. The number one choice for Bristol. This is BCFM 93.2.
Now we're going to have a look at, again with Kevin, at the National Security Agency. National Security Agency. Martin, if you can just give us that, please. We'll start like this. Let me introduce our reporter, Kevin Carhill from Exeter, and Vanny Vines, Kevin's personal press officer at the National Security Agency at Fort Meade in Maryland, USA, home of the largest spook agency in the world.
Hi, Vanny. It's me, Kevin, from England. How's the good old National Security Agency of the USA on this fine fall day?
Dandy, Kevin, just dandy. Now, what can I do for you?
Ah, Vanny, it's PRISM, you see. That email interception and data theft program you run over here. In the words of the song from Annie Get Your Gun, anything you can do, we can do too. So we're asking the government to enact a Rob American Banks Act, RABA for short.
A what, Kevin?
A special act of Parliament to legalise the robbing of American banks.
Hey man, that's crazy. You can't do that.
Oh yes, we can. By a majority of one, our Parliament can vote to dethrone our Queen. Getting an act through to rob your banks would be a lot easier.
You'd not get past the doors of a US bank before the cops were there.
Now, Vanny, we're imitating you. We're going to take the money from the 200 American banks over here.
But what we're doing is different. It's legal. We have a law here.
Legal on your side of the pond, Vanny, but not on ours. I know it will shock you to the core, but your laws don't run over here. That's why we'll take the money from your banks over here. That will be quite legal for us. We'll not call it robbing banks, just taking compo.
Our government will stop you.
Good point, Vanny. So far, our government, a crowd of cowardly cretins in Downing Street, have let your government break the law over here, steal children's data and intercept emails. Not nice, Vanny. So we expect a lot of support for RABA. We will suggest giving everyone who had data stolen by you £1,000. That will be about 80% of the population.
We'll send in the Marines.
Yeah, I thought you might think of that, Vanny, but we have our own Marines. We think they'll obey our laws, not yours. See you in the city, Vanny, with our Marines.
Okay, thank you, guys. But there's a serious point in the middle of all that, Kevin, isn't there? And that is that, effectively, what's going on at the moment is the surveillance program, PRISM, is actually invading all of our homes here in Britain, including gathering information that our children are doing on the internet. So you may have some kind of idea of, well, protecting kids from seeing content that you don't want them to on the internet, but actually still the NSA, through these effectively kind of front operations, it is collecting vast amounts of data on all of us, including kids.
Yeah, no, I mean, this is completely proven. One of the peers back in June described PRISM as criminal, and I have contacted the Home Office and the Cabinet Office on a number of occasions and asked them to, you know, is this man right or wrong? And they have refused to comment.
Okay, so why is it criminal?
Sorry?
Why is it criminal?
Well, I can't answer that at the moment, but they seem to be afraid of the American government or the American spooks.
Well, haven't we been afraid of the American government ever since the end of the Second World War? I can remember Duncan Campbell writing a couple of very good books back in the 1980s. One was The Unsinkable Aircraft Carrier, describing Britain as America's aircraft carrier. We also talk about Britain as the 51st state. And then he also wrote a book called War Plan UK, which was the first time it had been revealed that effectively if there was any kind of war situation around the world which Britain was involved in, effectively we'd have America here telling us what to do. We would be just simply part of a US chain of command.
Yeah, I think the issue of whether we have any independence over the Polaris missile should be raised again, over Trident. But this is the first time the United States has ever intruded right into the domestic life of the United Kingdom and stolen, you know, private data from everybody. And that includes Parliament.
Well, one of the things that Duncan Campbell said in his recent article on The Intercept was the reason that motivated him to look into it. And, of course, this was a part of a secret society series. There was quite a lot in the 1980s when the BBC made programmes like that back in the 80s, which was, he was saying effectively that the National Security Agency, Menwith Hill, the surveillance of phone lines, which was, of course, it was before the days of the internet, but that sort of thing could enable the imposition of a police state in Britain overnight?
Easily, because the front, what you call the front operation, the method they're using to steal the data and intercept the emails, affects about 80% of the users of the web in Britain.
How have you got evidence then that these internet companies are doing deals with the National Security Agency? You've obviously seen some of the Edward Snowden revelations about PRISM, because I wonder sometimes how companies like Twitter actually manage to be valued so much. Are some of these internet companies, people like Google, for example, actually taking money from the NSA?
They are indeed. This probably the company taking the biggest amount of money is Microsoft. But you ask, how did I prove it? The PRISM contracts are on the web. It's probably, you know, millions of people have seen them. Just look it up, PRISM, and it comes up. I have actually contacted all the companies, and I've sued three of them. And I'll be back. The first time, I lost because the law in Britain wasn't clear that you could sue American companies here. And last March, the appeal court fixed that. They have reminded people that if you do things in this country, you are liable under our laws.
Martin, what do you make of all this? Because effectively what it's doing is it's opening up Britain's privacy to the US National Security Agency.
Well, traditionally, before you know, modern internet and so on, the echelon, the Five Eyes, the deal was that you couldn't. Basically, the British.
Can I just stop you there? Because Five Eyes is a weird one, isn't it? It's five countries with five eyes. But no, hang on. Five countries should be 10 eyes. It's almost like each of these countries is just one eye.
Yes. Okay. Interesting aside. But the point is that the way they used to finesse it back in the '80s was that the British spies would spy on the American population and then tell the Americans what, you know, GCHQ, because of course GCHQ can spy on foreigners perfectly legitimately, and the US would do the same for the British and then give them the information. And of course the British and US intelligence services are part of the same game. They're pretty much the same outfit.
Well, there is this one great curiosity that GCHQ have issued a statement saying that they expect American companies in the United Kingdom to obey our laws. This is a bit of a novelty.
Yes, but it's. I mean, I hate to be so cynical, but actually, nobody is going to go into these companies and take evidence that will be able to be used in a court of law because they're all very, very hot on security. I mean, particularly people like the NSA and GCHQ are not going to let you or I, as journalists, wander in there and grab information, evidence, which then could be used against them to prove their criminal intent in a court.
The evidence is what you might call formal and forensic, and it's on the web, and it's in statements like those made by that peer in June, by Lord Laird. But here's an interesting point, and it's about the police. The police are aware of this, and the police in Devon and Cornwall are looking at it. What they're doing, I don't know. But the Home Office has tried to stop them. So you go back and say, well, who's stopping the police? Intercepting emails is a criminal offence under RIPA 1. So if the police are doing nothing, why not? And the answer is knock on the door of Downing Street. Downing Street has stopped every attempt to bring the American companies to justice in English courts.
What about the news today about people not getting their money through electronic bank accounts? Because this is a whole new world we're living in now, where everything seems to be digital money. We're moving away from cash. More and more of the money we spend is used on our little chips. I was noticing it's an RFID chip, isn't it, that's in your credit card nowadays, and your debit card, which can be used for contactless payments. And you can't even get on a London bus now with cash.
Yeah, if you wanted to bring the country to a complete halt, it's not very difficult. You just put really nasty bugs into the banking system, and that would probably be the most disastrous.
I mean, Martin, do you think that the banks are really motivated to stop that? Because at the end of the day, they can always just hold their hands up and say, sorry, Gov, we were hacked.
Well, I think that what it shows is the vulnerability of all of these systems. I mean, look at Snowden. He basically was able to get an MP3 with virtually everything they knew on it just by sitting as a low-level subcontractor in the setup. And, of course, what's actually happening in Russia and so on is they've gone back to using typewriters and not using telephones and so on. And if you're serious about security, that's what you've got to do.
But here's one of the problems. Take that really simple one. I know that my emails are being intercepted. The evidence is compelling. And the Investigatory Powers Tribunal has acknowledged that PRISM is running and has deemed it unlawful. Now, I want to do something about that, and I discover I can't do anything. You've got to go to the police. I went to the police 18 months ago, and they've done nothing. And as far as I know, this is because of pressure from Downing Street and the Home Office.
Another angle on all of this, I suppose, is the increasing power of the... I mean, we're talking about the NSA. The NSA budget's being used effectively to pay these internet companies. Quite what they're doing in exchange for it, is it the PRISM program that they're paying them for? For cooperation with the PRISM program?
Actually, it's surprising that some of the American media haven't actually looked at the accounts of the NSA and discovered how much money they are paying Microsoft, Apple. One of the curiosities, I asked Apple a month ago under the Safe Harbor Agreement to give me the National Security Agency's data protection principles, because the PRISM documents say that Apple is collecting information and being paid by the NSA. So Apple's answer is, never heard of PRISM.
No, come on. Come on, Apple.
I have it in writing.
See, obviously, they're very, very sensitive about this. I mean, we like to think that your Mac is something, it's a sort of cut above Microsoft and whatever, but of course, it clearly isn't. They're just two sides of the same coin. Martin, on a slightly different tack, great bit of investigation here by Press TV. Private US military contractors are indebted to shareholders. They say the US government has over 200,000 soldiers in over 120 countries around the world, yet it's got an insatiable appetite to use private military contractors. Total amount that the US spends on defense is $771 billion. Estimates vary, but up to a quarter of all defense spending goes on these private contractors. So we're talking about something like $200 billion on these private defence contractors. One example which goes beyond this amount is a spy agency dubbed Booz Allen, which has been revealed that 70% of the US intelligence budget goes to private contractors. That's what they say, especially on drone surveillance. So we've got this kind of massive industry growing up. Have you seen any documentaries about private defence contractors? I see nothing about this. Their role in destroying countries and also their role in supposedly rebuilding them.
Well, it's clearly a great big, on one level, it's a great big boondoggle, isn't it? There's loads of money being made out of the war on terror. But the other thing is, just from a security point of view, how can you privatise security of a state? Because it's basically not secure. You've not got a real military line of command.
Well, the problem is there that the company may be outbid by somebody else secretly behind the scenes.
Yes, well, right, well, why don't we get the Chinese security agency in to run it all? They'd do it at half the price, eh? But of course you can't.
Yeah, no, it was Eisenhower warned about the military-industrial complex, and this is just its new form. A lot of the war in Iraq was fought by private contractors, not by the American military.
Well, I suppose they are lobbying themselves, so they're lobbying for war. Martin, where are we at the moment in, for example, places like Ukraine and the Middle East?
Well, they're not just lobbying for war. What we suspect is that they're actually engaged in the commission of terrorism and then saying, oh, we need some more resources to deal with the terrorism that we've created.
Well, have you got evidence for that?
Yes, there's lots of evidence for that. I mean, we went to Gladio earlier on. Going back to the 60s and 70s and 1980s.
Well, hang on. What about now?
Well, what about now? The terrorism. Look at what's happening
ISIS,
in Syria.
ISIS.
Look at ISIS, yeah. In Syria. The Turkish police have actually demonstrated some independence. So they've done a couple of things. One of the things they did is they stopped a convoy of trucks going into Syria, taking arms to ISIS. And the people driving those trucks turned out to be MIT officers. That is to say, Turkish intelligence officers. You know what's happened to those Turkish police officers? They're now on trial for treason in Turkey. But the MIT is part of NATO, so we've got absolutely solid evidence there of a recent ilk that NATO is involved in supplying weaponry to ISIS.
And we've also got a lot of banksters around, and one of the people I've heard recently, a really fascinating analysis of what's going on with the economic system, is a chap called Michael Hudson. He's written a book called Killing the Host. And now you've talked about this before, Martin, haven't you? The idea that the financial system is like a parasite.
Indeed, and Michael Hudson is one of the top people who's able to take it apart, a bit like Steve Keen, who we had a clip of earlier in the program.
And here he is on Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman, talking about, first of all, the banksters, I suppose, the criminality that's now in the financial system here in the West, particularly, and then also talking about Greece, because he's an advisor to the Syriza party.
Michael Hudson, your book is titled Killing the Host, How Financial Parasites and Debt Bondage Destroy the Global Economy. Explain what you mean.
Well, most people think of parasites as sort of just taking money from the economy, and the 1% is sort of sucking up all the income from the 99%. But in nature, what parasites do, they don't simply take. In order to take, they have to take over the brain of the host. And economists have a word, host economy. It's for a foreign country that lets American investors in. Smart parasites help the host grow, but the parasite, first of all, has to make the host believe that the intruder is actually part of the body, to be nurtured and taken care of. And that's what's happened in national income accounting in America and in other countries. The newspapers and the media, not your show, but most of the media, treat the financial sector as if that's really the economy. And when the stock market goes up, the economy is going up, but the economy isn't going up at all, and the financial sector somehow depicts itself as the brains of the economy, and it would like to replace government. What Larry Summers said is what governments have to pay their debts by privatizing more, essentially by doing what Margaret Thatcher did in England. That's his solution to the crisis. All the governments have to do is balance the budget, sell everything to Wall Street on credit, and we won't have any more problem. And the financial sector is almost just at war, not only against labor, as most of the socialists talk about, but against governments and against industry. It's a cannibalizing industry. So now most of the corporations in America are using their income not to do what industrial capitalism did a century ago, not to build more factories and employ more people and make more profits. They're just using it, as I said, to push it to pay dividends and to buy back their shares and to somehow manipulate the financial sector and the stock prices, not the economy as a whole. So there's been a divergence between the real economy and what economists call the FIRE sector, finance, insurance, and real estate, and they're going in separate directions.
You have been an advisor to the Syriza party in Greece. You're a friend of the former finance minister, Yanis Varoufakis. Can you talk about what's happening there now and what that bodes for the economy, not only in Greece, but in Europe, maybe even here?
Well, the story begins actually about 4 years ago when Greece had a very large foreign debt taken on basically by the military government and what followed. And it was obvious that as soon as the PASOK, the Socialist Party, came in, they said, look, the debt's much larger than we thought. We can't pay it. And they were going to write it down. The IMF looked in and said, Greece can't pay the debts. We've got to write them down. The board looked in, said they can't pay the debts. But then the European Central Banks came in and said, look, our job as central bankers is to support the banks. Greece owes the debt to essentially French banks and German banks, and we've got to support them. So despite the fact that the IMF was pushing for a debt write-down 4 years ago, the head of the IMF at that time, Dominique Strauss-Kahn, wanted to run for president of France. And he was told by French President Sarkozy, well, wait a minute, if French banks hold most of Greek debts, you can't, at the IMF, say that we're going to write down the debt. So they didn't. And meanwhile, the Eurozone said, we won't let you, the IMF, be part of our program, the Troika, if you don't pretend that the that Greece can pay the debt. So Greece was left with a huge debt. It was pushed into depression. The GDP fell worse than it did in the 1930s. Finally, the Syriza party came in January. And Varoufakis and Tsipras thought that, okay, we can explain to the finance ministers of Europe that you can't expect to push Greece into a depression, push more austerity, and somehow austerity will enable us to repay the debt. That's crazy. And he thought that he could reason with them. And the Europeans who he was reasoning with, the central bankers, said, we're not here to talk about economics. We're lawyers. We're here to collect money. It doesn't matter that you're going to go into a depression. It doesn't matter that you're going to have another 20% of your population emigrate. We're only here to collect the payments. And if you don't pay, then we're going to pull the plug. And they pulled the plug on the Greek banks a few months ago and said, we're not going to accept any of the bank transfers payments with Greek banks here. So if you're exporting and you want credit for export, you're not going to give it to you. We're going to treat Greece like America treated Cuba and America treated North Korea. You're going to be the North Korea of Europe if you don't succumb, surrender, and pay. And that's why Tsipras said, we don't want to bring an absolute total crisis breakdown because that would bring the right wing to power. Varoufakis said, well, he agrees that there's no alternative but to surrender for the present and try to join hands with Italy, Spain, and Portugal. But he wasn't going to be the administrator of the depression. So you had the referendum, and the Greeks now say, well, no matter what, we're not going to pay. And the Eurozone says, then we're going to just wreck you or smash and grab.
Smash and grab. So, Martin, things have moved on since that interview just last week, which is now the Greeks have announced another general election.
Yeah, it's going to be interesting to see how that plays out. But I think it's rather... I think they weren't prepared. The Greek population wanted to stay inside the Eurozone and stay inside the Euro club. And that meant that their bargaining position was weakened. Because they should have said, we are prepared to pull the house down. But, of course, you can't force people
to say that. Well, that's what Michael was saying there, is that we'd possibly have brought in a far-right government.
If you bring the house down, you're bringing the house down. And the consequences are unpredictable. But ultimately, you can't can't really bargain with these people, as Michael Hudson was pointing out. And it'll take a while until people wake up and we have sufficiently robust social movements led by sufficiently clear-sighted leadership,
look,
which are prepared to take on
the banks. The people in Greece have woken up. They are realising that whatever way they vote, they're still going to get hammered.
Well, the people in Greece haven't woken up because one of the problems was, for the Syriza party, was that the Greeks wanted not to pay the debt, and they had all the arguments why they shouldn't pay it and why it should be cancelled and so forth. And incidentally, of course, Ukraine's just had 20% of its debt wiped out because they're good guys and they're not problematic, and we need their help to fight the Russians and so on. So it's all political. But the majority, the centre of Greek politics, still wants to stay in the euro and doesn't want to do the euro.
So what's your prediction for this Greek election then? Do you think it's going to be a veering away from Syriza?
Be a coalition.
It seems like Syriza have failed.
No, there'll be a coalition between the right wing of Syriza and the New Democrats, i.e. the Conservatives, and the left wing of Syriza will have to split. Varoufakis and others are forming a left wing of Syriza. But I think the real problem is in the psyche of the Greek electorate. They've had enough, they're sick of it all, they're fed up, but they're not sick and fed up enough to pull the whole house down and live with the consequences.
Well, what do you make of all this talk there of economic warfare, effectively by central banks, the Germans and the Swiss, as Michael was describing there, against the Greek people?
Well, this is exactly what's going on. It is economic warfare, it's all political. The debts of Greece were owed to private sector banks in France and Germany, and the logical free market solution is to let those banks collapse. If that happened, Germany would then be in the economic crisis which it's imposing on everybody else. But those debts were transferred to the public sector, and now the European Central Bank, the public sector, is demanding repayment of debts which were contracted by private parties. And that's what happens all the time. The private sector screws up, it hands the debt, the unpayable part of it, to the public sector, and then it becomes a political decision who's going to pay and on what basis. And don't forget that Greece is actually now thinking in terms of suing the German government for reparations for World War II. And in fact, the German government at the time took a hold of Greece's currency reserves. And of course, at the same time, also Germany itself was let off most of its debts by its international creditors in 1953, something which they failed to remember.
Kevin, what do you make of all of this?
Two tiny things. One is Ireland, where there is a very sharp recovery underway. It's kind of confined to Dublin, but there is. And they're starting to put the bankers on trial.
But, I mean, surely Ireland is having to do the same sort of thing as Greece is. They're privatising their water industry, for example, in Ireland. How's that all going?
There's at least 100,000 people have refused to pay. So there's social unrest.
I wonder how Bristol Water would get on, the worst water company in the country, by the way, according to Ofwat, the regulators, if nobody paid for their water in Bristol.
Well, this is one of the... But civil resistance, it goes back to what Martin was saying. The Greeks don't want to bring the house down because chaos will follow. It's the same in Ireland. But I was going to make... In Ireland, it was far simpler and clearer. Three private banks destroyed the country, but they were able to destroy the country because the government guaranteed them. But look at Iceland, where the recovery is complete, the bankers are in jail, and they let the banks go bust. BCFM.
And now on to another story, and that is our trip down to Hayling Island last weekend. He led from the front, conducting more raids on the coast of occupied Europe than any other man in World War II. Royal Navy Commander Harold Goulding, DSO, finally got the recognition he deserved last Friday. But why did it take 70 years? So we go now to the captain of the Medusa. This was a boat which was taking part, a ship really, I should say, in the flotilla, which was part of the celebrations to unveil these two blue plaques down in Hayling Island. It was called, I keep saying Operation for some reason, but no, it's HMS Northney. Even though it was on the shore, it was where all the commanders were being trained in the Second World War. So let's have a listen now to the Medusa's captain, Alan Watson. I spoke to him last Friday.
I'm Alan Watson. I'm Medusa Skipper and one of her trustees. And today is all about commemorating Commander Golding, who his granddaughter's here. He was quite a remarkable man, and he was commanding officer of HMS Northney on Hayling Island. A lot of important things happened here. It was the birth of the SBS, amongst other things. There was the parties here that went across and surveyed the D-Day beaches, and all sorts of other things. And his life's been largely unrecorded, and this is an opportunity to put that right.
It's strange, isn't it, that someone who'd be so decorated in the war, was in a very important position in the Royal Navy, should take such a long time for him to get proper recognition.
I think it was a combination of everything being wound up and shut down at the end of the war, and the secrecy that prevailed. The sort of things that he was involved in just were not spoken about. So the documents would have remained secret, and it was really quite by chance that this all came to light.
Tell us about some of the other units that were under the special boat unit that he was commanding down here.
One of them was called COPP, the Combined Pilotage Party, and one of their tasks was to go across to the other side and survey the D-Day beaches before any landings took place, because it was important to know what the sand composition was, whether the beach was strong enough to drive a tank up it, all that sort of thing.
Well, how do you do that under the noses of the Nazis?
Quite simply, they paddled ashore in little boats, crept up the beach, took sand samples, and paddled away again. And there's one story of one where they're laying on the beach and the sentry walked straight past them. So quite remarkable people, really.
What about other groups that were part of SBU?
They were small-scale raiding parties, and it was a thing that really came out of World War II, was the sort of start of what you might call unconventional warfare, the idea of very small parties that could cause a lot of grief beyond their size. And they formed and trained here, and went off and did raids on all sorts of places.
What about this particular vessel?
Medusa is what's called a Harbour Defence Motor Launch, HDML, and she's 72 feet long, weighs 50 tonnes, and the original design concept of these was there was a worry about submarines penetrating UK harbours and causing grief, and so these were designed to patrol offshore of harbours, detect submarines, depth charge them, and then she's heavily armed to sort them out when they came to the surface. As it happens, the threat didn't really materialise, and so this class of vessel, there were some 480 of them, they were used for all sorts of purposes, from convoy patrol to offensive operations, very popular for agent landing, which is primarily why we're here today, because they're a very, very quiet vessel with a tiny radar signature, so they're almost undetectable, sort of the original stealth craft, if you like.
And that was Alan Watson, captain of the Medusa. So he brought us in to the Langstone, which was where the base of HMS Northney was, where we had a ceremony to unveil the blue plaques. And Harold Goulding's grandson, Charlie Goulding, was there.
Distinguished guests, ladies and gentlemen, I know I speak for the Goulding family that are here today about how proud we are and how humbled by today's event. My father would have been emotionally moved to see today unfold. He tried in the 50s to find out what my granddad had been involved in during the war, but due to his clandestine activities and the Top Secrets Act, was unable to gain much information. What my father did already know, my grandmother had some possessions of my grandfather. These being a tunic that had a silk lining of the French coast. It also had buttons that had compasses and various things on them. She also had a machine gun, or his machine gun. We're very good when we used to go around there. She had a machine gun that was my grandfather's that had interchangeable barrels that would fire ally and enemy ammunition. This effort has accumulated in today's flotilla and the plaque unveilings in memory of my granddad. I'm sure she has a lot more to do, and I look forward to more information about granddad into the future. If we could all put our hands together to thank Jill for her efforts, that would be great.
Yes, and if you go into the archives of this show, you'll hear my interview with Jill Goulding I conducted back in January this year. Now, probably the one of the most interesting people there was Ram Seeger from the SBS Society, and I spoke to him too.
My name is Ram Seeger, Ram because my initials are A.M. I was a former Royal Marine and member of the Special Boat Squadron in those days, but now Special Boat Service. My connection is the obvious one, that Harold Goulding was commander of the Special Boat Unit, which was an attempt by Mountbatten to coordinate all the different seaborne special forces, which included the Royal Marine Boom Detachment, who we are probably descended from, but I think we could probably claim descendants from the Special Boat Unit.
Special Boat Squadron, what was that originally designed to do?
Well, they were a special force, so that means moving in small groups in isolated circumstances, behind the enemy lines or whatever, to carry out a reconnaissance task or offensive task, blowing things up, that kind of thing.
So give us an idea of the sort of operation that might have been conducted out of Hayling Island.
Well, a classic SBS operation probably is Blondie Hazard's attack on the shipping in Durand River, Bordeaux. That was a long time ago, but that's still the sort of thing we train for. But
that's Ram Seeger there from the SBS Society. Now, Martin, the real mystery here is why it's taken 70 years, but as you and I have talked about on this show, there was an operation conducted using the COP commandos that were mentioned there to grab Martin Bormann. At least that's the allegation by John Ainsworth Davis under the pen name Christopher Crichton.
Yes, and of course there was a suggestion that the Dieppe, just as we've was possibly a fix by to put John Ainsworth Davis into the German structure so that they would trust him, and in other words that the Dieppe was deliberately failed.
Yeah, the other thing about the book Op JB it is that Christopher Crichton, John Ainsworth Davis talks about there is he said that there was a cover story for the Bormann raid, and that was that the money that they were going to bring out from Nazi Germany at the end of the Second World War was going to be shared out. And then people like Goulding might have been rather annoyed if their men were used for an operation which was effectively where the money was then taken over to South America.
Well, the main allegation in Op JB is that Martin Bormann was rescued by the SBS from Berlin at the end of the war, taken back to Britain and then taken off to Argentina because he knew where all the money was.
Anyway, so if you want to find out more about this, there's two books, Op JB by Christopher Crichton, and the other one is Paul Manning's book, Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile. Time to sign off now for the Murdoch News at 7. I'm off to Tehran this weekend, so the nuclear deal's been signed and we have a British embassy back again. We'll be taking a look at Iran next week. Sister Show Dialect on BCFM, Tuesdays at noon, more with Steve Keynes.
Pacifica Radio, this is Voices of the Middle East and North Africa. I am Malihe Razazan.
And I'm Khalil Bendi. Renowned Israeli historian Ilan Pappe is the author of numerous books on the history of Zionism, including his seminal work, The Ethnic Cleansing of Palestine, The History of Modern Palestine, and the Israel-Palestine Question. In his new book on Palestine, co-authored with Noam Chomsky, Ilan Pappe debates issues spanning from the BDS movement to the one-state solution. I spoke with Professor Pappe about this new work. Ilan, your most recent book, co-authored with Noam Chomsky and titled On Palestine, offers a nice contrast between the old and the new left perspectives on the question of Palestine, between two generations of thinking on this question. One of the most marked contrasts is the fundamental question of the so-called two-state solution, which much of the left, the liberal left in this country, following in the footsteps of the revered Amnon Scrise of the American left, Dr. Chomsky, essentially abandons the moral high ground of equal rights for all in the name of pragmatism.
you speak of an old conversation versus a new conversation and talk of a paradigm shift. Tell us a little bit more about this.
Yeah. The idea emanated from my thinking that whenever I go around outside of Palestine and talk to people, people hesitate about this idea of the two states and one state and say to me, you know, it's up to the people themselves to decide. It's not our role outside of Palestine or outside of the Palestinian or Israeli context to give advice to people what is the right or wrong solution. And I usually answer, and that's the point I make in the book, that it's not a question of whether you support that or other solution only. Of course, it's part of it. But the most important aspect of this is, do you understand the implication of the paradigm of two-state solution? Because otherwise you are entangled in question, is this feasible, is one state feasible, which is not yet the debate to my mind. The main debate is what lies behind the idea of a two-state solution. And what lies behind the idea of a two-state solution is if the Jewish national movement and the Palestinian national movement arrived more or less at the same time to the same place and were unable to settle the question to whom the land belongs and were unable to reconcile, and what you needed is kind of a grown-up in the form of the United States and for that Britain, they would help these two sides to reconcile on the basis of a kind of an American business-like approach where you divide the land, you divide the responsibility, and so on. And that's a very wrong way of reading the whole history of Palestine since the arrival of the Zionist movement there in the late 19th century until today. This is not a conflict between two national movements fighting over the same piece of land. This is a struggle between a settler movement, a settler colonialist movement, which arrived in the late 19th century in Palestine and tries and still tries today to colonize Palestine by having most of the land with as few of the native people on it as possible. And the struggle of the native people is an anti-colonialist struggle. So you have to come back to any historical case studies you remember of an anti-colonialist movement fighting a colonialist power and ask yourself at any given moment, was the idea of partitioning the land between the colonizer and the colonized portrayed as a reasonable solution, especially by people who were on the left or saw themselves as conscientious members of their society? And the answer is a resounding no. Of course, you would not support the division of Algeria between the French settlers and the native Algerians. And even in places where you had settler colonialism, namely where you had white people who had nowhere to go in a way, like in the tip of Africa, in South Africa, if you would suggest today as a progressive person that you should divide South Africa between the white population and the African population, you would be regarded at best as insane and at worst as someone who is insincere and a fascist. The fact that this logic, which is so clear to many people on any other place in the world, somehow fails to work in the case of Palestine, and I think that's why it was so important for me to explain that part of the problem is what I call the old orthodoxy, the old language we used, even as progressive people, even as people who supported the Palestinians on the issue of Palestine, the language of the two states, which actually was a language that did not describe aptly the reality on the ground in Palestine.
One fundamental problem that you raise is that, unlike in the fight against apartheid, where opponents of apartheid had no qualms about being against the actual notion, the actual ideology of apartheid, a lot of the solidarity movement with Palestine dare not denounce the nature of Zionism. And whenever that happens, it's considered or called anti-Semitism in Europe and the U.S. Tell us more why that is a fundamental flaw of the movement.
Yes, definitely. This is an important example It is connected to another term, well, maybe we'll come back to it later in the conversation, that I suggest, and instead of just talking about one-state solution, I suggest talking about the regime change.
Yes, yes, we'll talk about that.
Then we'll probably come back to this. But the two are connected in the sense that when we analyze the situation in Palestine, when we ask ourselves why were Palestinians expelled massively in 1948, why were the Palestinians in Israel put under military rule between 1948 and 1967, why was this military rule transferred from inside Israel to the occupied West Bank and the Gaza Strip in 1967, why are the Bedouins in the south of Israel and the Palestinian villages in the north of Israel today are subject, like those who live in Jerusalem, to a policy of Judaization, namely of expropriation of land and strangulation in their own places of habitation. And then, of course, when we add to this the question, why does Israel refuse to allow the refugees to return and imposes such an inhuman siege on Gaza? When we ask all these questions and we look for the reason why is it done, we know now better than we ever knew before that the reason for this is ideological. It's a Zionist ideology. All these policies are tactics which attempt to keep the land of Palestine as part of Israel without calculating demographically the Palestinians as part of the citizenship of that land. And this idea of separating the rights of the, or segregating the rights of the people, is familiar to us. Now, this is an ideology. This is not a tactical response to a problem. This is not just a policy. It's not even a strategy. This is a vision, a Zionist vision shared by all the Zionist parties. Now, this is the main, almost exclusive obstacle to peace and reconciliation in Israel and Palestine. And not addressing it, but only addressing an Israeli policy here or there, would be similar to addressing certain policies of South Africa during the heyday of apartheid without touching apartheid at all. And this, of course, is complicated even further, that not only do politicians and mainstream media and academia people refuse to acknowledge that the main reason for the inhumanity that rages in Palestine in the last century is the Zionist ideology. Not only do they ignore it, they accuse anyone who does it of being an anti-Semitic, as if you attacked apartheid as an ideology during the heydays of this dark regime, you would be accused of being an anti-Christian. As you probably noticed in the book, I'm even more bewildered by this because large sections of the society in the Western world already understand it. And they are being condemned by their own political elites for being anti-Semites, despite the fact, by the way, that many of them are Jews anyway.
Well, then they're self-hating Jews. So yeah, there's no escaping this stigma.
It's a case that if you sort of look at it with cold, sober eyes, it's insane. It is really insane to accuse progressive, for example, progressive Jewish activists in the United States who stood at the forefront of the struggle for civil rights in the 1960s, who initiated the solidarity movement against apartheid in South Africa, were vocal in the opposition to imperialism in Vietnam, in Chile, in other places, to accuse these people when they apply the same human rights universal yardstick to Israel, to accuse them of being self-hating Jews, for instance, show you that this is just an abnormality, and it is, can only be, probably can be produced by intimidation, lobbying, and pressure, and probably quite a high share of Islamophobia. Otherwise, it's very difficult logically to explain why this very humane a normal way of looking at the situation is treated in such a way.
In your book on Palestine, co-authored with Noam Chomsky, you speak of this term peace orthodoxy, which you accuse of being more of a racist than pragmatic tendency. You go as far as saying that among the pushers of a two-state solution, quote, the dictionary of the peace orthodoxy sprang out of an almost religious belief in the two-state solution, and that comes straight out of a contemporary version of Orwell's 1984.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a newspeak. I mean, I'm using Orwell here in his reference to newspeak, the kind of language that does not only disable us from calling a spade, it's called exactly the opposite. And usually a cruel reality is described as a benevolent one in the newspeak of Orwell. And I think the same is true about these words, which for me are sacred. I mean, peace, justice, reconciliation are three of the sacred, the most sacred words in our vocabulary as human beings. They really represent the highest form of human ambition to live peacefully with one another. Now, to use these languages in order to cover up for a process on the ground which achieves exactly the opposite. Instead of reconciliation, it sows more dissent and animosity and hatred. Instead of peace, it creates war. And instead of justice, it maintains an apartheid system. When these words are used as a protective shield to describe a reality that is exactly the opposite of what they mean, this, for me, is even worse than racism in a way. This is the kind of the Orwellian nightmare that I have when people begin to use words in such a way. And I think what happened, and I try to describe that in the introduction to the book, is that the idea of a two-state solution began as a Zionist Israeli ploy after 67 to reconcile a very simple problem. They have kicked out a million of Palestinians in 1948, but because of their territorial appetite, they wanted to take those parts of Palestine that they did not occupy in 1948, the West Bank and the Gaza Strip. But with the territory came another 1.5 million Palestinians, today almost 3 million Palestinians. And in order to reconcile the fact that you now have the whole of the land, but you still are left with a demographic nightmare, as far as the Zionist movement was concerned, one of the means they have used was the peace process. The peace process was used as a kind of a message to the world which says, as you can see, we are now robbing the Palestinians in the occupied territories of any basic human rights and civil rights. As you can see, we are expropriating their land. We are building Jewish settlements on them. We are expelling them quite massively. And we imprison them, even if they dare just to raise the Palestinian flag. Now, what the peace process means for the Israelis is a message to the world, this is all temporary. Of course, when peace comes, all these measures will be removed. Now, of course, you can understand why people on the Western left would have succumbed to this explanation after 5 years of occupation or 10 years of occupation. One can still see why one could still be hopeful that the Israelis mean it or that the world has the power to force Israel to mean it. But after almost 50 years, to still stick to this idea, which is an Israeli kind of ploy to deepen the colonization of the areas they've occupied in 1967 and to wipe out any possibility of negotiating the areas they've occupied in 1948 or the return of the refugees, to do that is really to be very stagnant and dogmatic in one's perception of the reality. And you would have expected critical voices on the American and European left to be a bit more alert to the kind of trap they have found themselves in, which Israel very cleverly has put there in a way.
You say that ethnic cleansing is in the very DNA of the Jewish state, so-called, and that change cannot come from within, and that it will have to come, as in South Africa before it, from outside. Thus the need for a worldwide movement to force Israel, or to force a regime change, as you were saying, in Israel. Tell us more about this regime change idea, which out here in the States has got a rather negative connotation.
Yeah, of course. Of course. I connect it to another kind of way that proper language was fouled by people. I think when masses went on demonstrations in Egypt and elsewhere, in Tunisia, in the Arab world, and demanded that the regime would fall, I think most of us would identify with it. That we thought this was a non-violent, massive movement of people who said to their government, you are not democratic, you are authoritarian, we want your regime to change. But the only regime change that worked, as we know, was the one that was toppled by the American Air Force and air power together with its allies in Iraq and Afghanistan. And the horrific consequences of this can be seen today. On the other hand, we've seen the fall of authoritarian regimes in Latin America, in Eastern Europe, and regime change there was not always a bloody attack by foreign forces against the will of the people. So regime change is what you make it. It's by itself, it's not a negative term. It depends which regime you change and how you change it.
Yes.
And I just said that if this is now a legitimate conversation among the strategists in America, among the policy makers, and they claim, although I like you, I'm very doubtful how sincere they are, but they claim that they would like to see non-democratic regime turns into the democratic regime. Putting aside the cynicism about it, in some cases, it's amazing that when, again, as in the case of ideology, when you raise this possibility about Israel, you are immediately branded again as someone who wants to see the destruction of the Jewish people. But for me, it's even more than that. I am aware of the balance of power. And even with the greatest help from the outside to change the reality in Israel, it would not be an easy project to convince the millions of Jewish settlers who live here today, already in the third generation, to give up the privileges, the power of what they have. And of course, an international pressure on them can help do that. But even more than that, we have to realize that building an international pressure from the outside, as any Palestinian living on the ground today will tell you, is a very lengthy and slow process. And while we wait for that pressure from the outside to materialize, the pace of destruction on the ground has accelerated. And we are facing a danger where even when we will succeed in recruiting that effective international pressure, there will be very little to salvage on the ground. And because of that, I think it's also important to have realistic goals for the movement that struggles from within. We've created a one-state movement, which we call the ODS, the One Democratic State, all over Palestine, including in Ramallah, in Jaffa, in Haifa. And we, Palestinians and Jews, we strongly believe that we should also achieve small steps towards a regime change. That if we cannot force the government to change its apartheid laws, its policies of ethnic cleansing, and in Gaza, of genocide, we will try and create enclaves that indicate that there's an alternative way of living, that we will continue to resist these policies as a massive movement. It's not just the outside pressure here that will work. I think it's very important to set a realistic goal and a worthy goal for the people who struggle on the ground. If you listen to the Palestinian Authority, the only goal Palestinians should fight for is a Bantustan in Ramallah. And this is not igniting anyone's imagination, as you can see. It does not terrify the Israelis. On the contrary, they're very happy with this as a kind of ultimate goal of the Palestinian struggle. And it does not offer anything to progressive Jews who understand that they live in a settler colonialist society, but it's still their homeland, and they would like to live in a more just society. So I think the regime change here is not only the what you expect the outside world to do. It's the kind of thing you want to do on the ground, even if you can only move very slowly towards this or only one step at a time. It unites people, it gives them a clear target, and sways them away from false paradigms of peace, such as the two-state solution.
You just mentioned the term apartheid, and the parallel between South Africa and Palestine is indeed both striking and inspiring. for the future. But Chomsky, in this book on Palestine, replies to you that things aren't that simple, and that in South Africa, a couple of things were different. Settler colonialism was not, as it is in Palestine, accomplished in a way to replace the native population. And that in South Africa, the Cuban military intervention in the 80s managed to help defeat apartheid even militarily. And again, the equivalent may not be apparent in Palestine. What do you reply to these two criticisms by Noam Chomsky?
Oh, I think he's right. And there are many other differences between the two case studies. But I think where Chomsky and I differ is this dim line that I think that it was the late Edward Said who was the best person to define the dim line, much better than I would now. But there's a dim line between a scholarly analysis and the analysis of an activist. From a scholarly point of view, there are many aspects of the reality in South Africa which are different from those in Palestine. I could mention the lack of any equivalent to the Jewish lobby in the case of South Africa. I can mention also the Holocaust as a game changer in the history of Palestine, and there's nothing equivalent to this in the case of South Africa. And of course, there are differences in the way the apartheid regime manifested itself in South Africa and in the way the ethnic cleansing paradigm of structure in Israel was working. But these are minute issues that do not really undermine the basic comparison, which is the most important one. And there are three issues here which I think can only be understood if you see your role not just then as a scholar who compares two case studies, but as an activist who wants to be inspired by a successful struggle and transfer this success to a struggle that so far has not been successful. And the three points are the following. A is the international image of apartheid South Africa and the international image of Israel. In many cases, what Israel is doing is far worse than South Africa has done. This has been acknowledged by South African leaders. This has been acknowledged by many conscientious people around the world. So why can't we receive the same kind of international condemnation of Israel as a rogue state as we could in the case of South Africa? And one of the reasons that we can't do it is because we haven't done enough towards achieving it. It's not impossible. As the BDS movement has shown in its very short history, with its amazing achievements so far, we can definitely do it. The second point is the inspiration that the younger generation of activists, especially in the West, received from the days of the struggle in the pro-ANC, or the anti-apartheid movement in the West. The Israeli Apartheid Week has transformed the American and European campuses into spaces where Israeli official spokespersons are not welcome. This could not have been done if we would have stuck to a kind of a minute academic comparison between apartheid South Africa and Israel. This could only be done when people understood that the same energy that infuriated decent people in the West about the realities in South Africa infuriates people now about the reality in Palestine. And there was no need to invent the wheel. Even if, as many scholars have shown, the apartheid in Israel was a bit different from the apartheid in South Africa. And thirdly, and the most important point of view to my mind, it's something to do with family names and first name. The family name is racism. South African apartheid was a racist society. Israel is a racist society. Yes, they have different first names, but they belong to the same family. And this family is outcast, at least officially, all around the world, except in one case. And you cannot highlight this exceptionalism if you don't show the last case of exceptionalism that was successfully challenged. And I think that's why it's so important not to stick always to the minute facts, to the scholarly, careful comparing of categories and subcategories, and sometimes allow yourself to be swept by the energy that comes from the activists. And that energy sometimes intuitively, not academically, intuitively realizes what is comparable and what is not comparable, and what is inspirational and what is not inspirational. You know, I'm editing a book that compares South Africa to Israel. And scholars there show the differences. men in much more detailed manner than the norm describes in the book. However, I think what is common to all these scholars is an understanding that dealing in the comparative study with South Africa opened their eyes about the possibilities in Palestine, changed the way they framed the reality in Palestine. In fact, it is the South African model, if you want, or case study, that enabled us to just blow away the two-state solution, not just as an impossible settlement, but one, a very dangerous one. And I don't think you could have had this perspective unless you understood also how the settler colonialist movement worked in South Africa.
Again, in opposition to the more quote-unquote pragmatic Chomsky, you place not only the right of return for all Palestinians at the heart of an eventual solution to the Palestinian question, but also reparations for what happened to the Palestinians over the past 60-plus years.
Yeah.
Explain to us how this is not necessarily just a utopian dream,
yeah,
and how these two essential conditions are central to a true solution for the future of Palestine-Israel.
Yes, indeed. I think my departure point on the right of return is very different from those who would assess its pragmatically, namely, is it feasible, or even on the question, which anyway is debatable, does Israel have, doesn't have the capacity to absorb such a large number of people should all the refugees want to come back. I think this is not now the issue, and that's not the reason we are not bringing up, and we all have been bringing up the issue of right of return. The right of return is a symptom of the racist nature of the Zionist regime in Israel. That's the main problem. The objection of Israel to the right of return stems from the same ideological reasoning that lies behind the Judaization policy in the Galilee, the destruction of Bedouin villages in the Nakab, in the south of Israel, from the Bantustanization of the West Bank and the ghettoization of Gaza. It stems from the same reason, and as a Zionist, you always wanted it from the late 19th century till today. You want to have as much of the land as possible with as few people as possible. And therefore, when you support the right of return, you're not only recognize an individual right that the international community sanctions in Resolution 194 from the 11th of December 1948, and you are not only adhere to all the international conventions about the refugees' right of return. No less important, you refuse to accept as legal, as moral, and as political acceptable the idea that the native people have no right to be in their own homeland. And I think that's the main issue. Now, of course, and again, I come to the difference between academic work and an activist perspective. Academics will tell you, and rightly so, that if you do an anthropological analysis among refugees in refugee camps, among Palestinians who live in exilic communities, in places where some of them are even made it, you know, made it personally, you will get absolutely different interpretation how they view the implementation of the right of return. Of course, people would have different view if they are now refugees for the second time in Lebanon from the destroyed Yarmouk refugee camp, and if they live
in Syria,
yes, they will have a different perspective. Mm-hmm. But they will all. But this is not the point. The point of the right of return is not at this moment its feasibility. Is it pragmatic given the fact that Israel is against it? No. It is what does it indicate? What does it indicate? And we had a horrific example for that, that of course the Western media has totally ignored, and I think on purpose. And I don't know, I don't remember if I mentioned it in the book, but I did mention it recently in an article. The only country neighboring Syria that did not receive one refugee, the only country, was Israel. All the other neighbors of Syria, with all their internal problems, with all their poverty, with all their more negative aspects of their regimes and so on, did not reject the refugees of Syria and gave them a shelter. The only country was the richest neighbor of Syria, and it did not even stretch its hand from a humanitarian point of view. Forget about politics. To say say to the people who live in Yarmouk, we know that your brothers and sisters, and I'm not using it metaphorically, the real brothers and sisters, and their nephews and their cousins live in the Galilee and are waiting for you to host you, to give you a temporary solution to the inferno that you are in. The only thing Israel is doing, it treats some of the more fanatic Islamic fighters in its hospitals to mend them and send them back so that the conflict in Syria will continue. But this shows you where the right of return is. And as I mentioned, I think in the book, definitely mentioned in other places, there are 250,000 Palestinian internal refugees. Israel refuses to allow even one of them to return to their demolished villages. So it all comes from the same place. So if you use pragmatic reasons to explain why the right of return is utopian, is not feasible, you say that to oppose Zionist racism is utopian, is not realistic. Okay, if this is your point of view, that's your point of view. I find fighting racism the most realistic, most less utopian mission I've taken upon myself as a grown-up.
So it's for you both a question of principle, of universal values, but at the same time it is the ground and the fundament, the basis for something that might actually work in the future.
Absolutely. There's a famous research by Salman Abu Sitta who showed that most of the refugees can be settled in their original places and not remove even one of the Jews who live there. And there are mechanisms for how to settle a return. It has been done before. And in order to heal the wounds, not only in Palestine, in order to heal the wounds in the rest of the Arab world, you will need to have a closure of the Palestinian refugee problem. And the only way is at least to recognize the individual right of every one of them, even if many or few, we don't know, will decide to implement it. If you begin with the problem of implementation in a country that very gladly accepted 1 million ex-Russian Jews without any infrastructural problem, then you are just falling into the trap of avoiding the question, why does Israel reject the right of return, not whether the right of return is possible or feasible. And I think, of course, it's possible and it's feasible. Peace is possible. Reconciliation is possible. We've seen it in South Africa. It's only what is sometimes very difficult is to convince the people who have all the natural resources in their hands, all the privileges, all the land, to redistribute these assets in order that everyone could live in relative peace and justice.
That is renowned Israeli historian Ilan Pape speaking with Khalil Bendib about his new book on Palestine. We'll hear more after a break. This is an encore presentation of Voices of the Middle East and North Africa.
Also mentioned, and this is coming back to the parallel between Palestine and South Africa, knowing that so many people of goodwill, progressives, people who are not racist, who fought against racism, were disappointed at the outcome of a post-apartheid, so far, post-apartheid South Africa, where people are just as unhappy, if not worse, in many ways, at least economically, in what has followed in the footsteps of apartheid. So you mentioned the importance in this book on Palestine of a more just and egalitarian economic system as part of the solution in Palestine. And this also may sound utopian today because we're in the throes of this incredibly fundamentalist economic neoliberal system. But again, that may not last forever. And you point out that this is part of the solution, that beyond just equal rights for everyone, you will also need a more egalitarian system.
Exactly. Let me put it this way. There are two issues one has to say about the economic apartheid in South Africa that continues. on the one hand, it should not undermine the success of getting rid of the political apartheid. It's not the same South Africa. As I said in my last tour in South Africa to people who kept questioning me about that, I said, well, you have boarded the train to end the political apartheid, and you reach the final station, and now you have to board the train to end the economic apartheid. Mm. It doesn't mean the journey has ended. I said, we in Palestine were still looking for the station to begin the trip to end the political apartheid. So from our perspective, things have changed in South Africa, but we are fully aware of the road still not taken. Now, the second thing is that, of course, you can learn from this. You can learn, and we have an example in the form of the Palestinian Authority, in the form of the international neoliberal aid to the West Bank, hundreds of millions that help unintentionally, I think in most cases one should say, sustain the Israeli control over the West Bank and do not change in any fundamental or meaningful way the reality on the ground, even if some of the donors would have liked to use that money for good purposes. And that means that when you have the time to talk about what I call the regime change, and you're looking for these small stations on the way to the big success, sometimes, for instance, working for social justice is no less important than working for the general justice. And the more the struggle integrates fully both values, the more it will become realistic. And there's one very good example. I don't think you can really build a different reality in Palestine if you don't redistribute land, because Zionism was built mainly on the expropriation of land. If there are today 12 million people between the River Jordan and the Mediterranean, and half of them are Palestinians and half of them are Jews, the Jews have more or less 85% of the land. That is, 6 million people have 85% of the land. Now, if there ever will be a goodwill or even a successful international campaign, this is not a basis for building anything new on the ground.
Yes.
And therefore, this has to be integrated into the new conversation, into the educational project that we are trying to push forward, as I do and others, on the ground in Israel and in Palestine, and also part of the international conversation about it. But, you know, it's quite simple in a way, because the two-state solution fits so well to the neoliberal paradigm, where you look at Israel and Palestine and you claim that you are using a very sensible measure called partition between two conflicting sides. But you give one side 80% of the land and one side 20% of the land, and you sell it as a fair deal. That's neoliberalism. That's exactly neoliberalism, the idea that economic balance of power determines what equality means. And in reality, it's inequality in essence. But again, this new speak of neoliberalism is very, very important. Now, I'm a bit more optimistic than you may be on this, because I'm an historian, and I think something cracked in the capitalist system in 2008. And all the cosmetic solution that seem now to work, with everybody looking at the green screens and not on the red screen, and Wall Street and all the other measures that you have to look at economic growth and so on, I think this is a facade. The reality is that 2008 exposed to people who haven't read Marx, who haven't been brought up as socialist, the sinister side of that system. It was very interesting to see how Naomi Klein moved from a totally focused ecological agenda to a far more sober, in my mind, agenda that connects capitalism to even to ecological disaster. I think all these things indicate that we are in the beginning of a process that at least, I don't know if it will be successful, but with all the distractions, and the most important of them is Islamophobia among them, with all the distractions of what really preoccupies a person, even in the West, as if they're more occupied with terrorism than they are with their social security, all these things are not going to be sustained easily by the powers that be. I know that they are immense and they are omnipotent in many ways, but I think that they are finding it in the age of information very difficult to continue to deceive, disinform, and distract people from the realities on the ground. And I think it would be great if we could integrate the Palestine issue to this conversation about social justice in America, in Latin America. And we're beginning to do this. You know, it's not surprising. You can go to Norway and you can see people, women, demonstrating in a textile factory for wages, waving the Palestinian flag, and you ask them why the Palestinian flag, and they will tell you it's for us today. This is a symbol of social justice.
Yes, and yeah, wearing keffiyehs. Yeah, that's true.
And you see it elsewhere.
Yeah, and this book on Palestine with Chomsky, as well as in your previous one, you speak of the production, the all-important concept of production of knowledge, as a fundamental tool for perpetuating the status quo and the continuation of the cleansing of Palestine. This as well is controversial because even outside Israel, this production of knowledge when it comes to the subject of Palestine is largely controlled by pro-Israel forces. Why is that such a taboo? I mean, Chomsky in particular refuses to take that into account. He downplays it fiercely. And the source of this bias is never something that enters the discussion. And he claims that it's simply imperialism at work, a thirst for petroleum, etc. And a huge chunk of the American left and European left as well agree with that, or they follow Chomsky in that direction. Is that fact as irrelevant as it's made out to be, the fact that the people of the book are in charge of the production of knowledge even outside Israel? Not exclusively, but they have a large power in the publishing industry and the news media and Hollywood, etc. Is that not part of the what we're up against?
Well, I think it's a very static analysis. I think production of knowledge is a dynamic process. It's not that if you sort of take a still picture of it, then yes, this is a fair description. But if you try to video it, it's a slow movement, of course. It's a slow movement. It's a tectonic movement. It's not an earthquake. But, it's a slower kind of movement of blocks, if you want. But it's happening. I cannot understand how people can say it when you compare the kind of things that were written, taught, and studied on Palestine until the 1980s and compare it to our days. There is a fundamental change in the way knowledge is produced about Palestine. It is true that, as in the case of the media, also in the case of the academia, the mainstream academia is timid, sometimes Islamophobic, and therefore these changes have not reached the important, if you want, basis of production of knowledge. And this also is connected to capitalism and neoliberalism. I mean, universities today work on the assumption that they can, like big banks, determine which is an important publication and which isn't, and therefore the power, capital, and knowledge are still connected in a way that serves the Israelis, if you want, better than the Palestinians. Well, serves anyway. Anyone who's disempowered doesn't serve anyone who's disempowered in society. But if you only look at this, it means you take it out of the context of the revolution in knowledge production we had through the internet, for instance, in the growing sense of suspicion, even among academics themselves, about the way knowledge is produced and about the hierarchy of knowledge production. Again, these are, I understand what's happening here because these are very slow changes and people would like to see maybe quicker tangible results and they don't have the patience to look at things in a more historical perspective. But I'm an historian and I can see the change and I can see the transformation and I think that Noam, for instance, kind of brushes aside the decision taken by the American Studies Association, the Linguistic Association, the upcoming decision of the Middle Eastern Studies Association. You know, he doesn't think that they're very important. I think they're highly significant. I think they're highly significant. We are beginning to scratch the edges of the power centers. Yes, these are not yet the power centers themselves, but we're very, very close. And to this, you have to add something else. On the ground in Israel, as the last elections have seen, the inevitable result, the inevitable, if you want, other outcome of Zionism unfolds in front of our eyes. One consequence was the horrible consequence for the Palestinians, but the other one, we suddenly realized that Zionism was a horrible trap for the Jews in Israel as well. The kind of policies that are now enacted, the kind of ideology that now sort of pours out of what is Israel today, does not allow even progressives, even Jews who were liberal Zionists, to remain indifferent to Israel, and they are trying now to find a way of telling us, don't identify us with them. Even without doing anything, Israel is accelerating the pace by which it becomes a pariah state. And this will have an effect also on the production of knowledge. But I think we should never underestimate what has happened since the 1980s. It's impossible in any serious place to sell the Zionist narrative as a serious narrative. Those who do accept it as a serious narrative almost openly admit that they do it because either they got the money or they're just afraid of someone. But very few people will tell you that this is because it deflects what they really think about the reality.
You mentioned earlier in our discussion what you call the Jewish lobby, what we usually call the Israel lobby, to not brush the whole entire Jewish community, because people are very sensitive about that. But in reality, when you look at how it works in this country, certainly in the U.S., it's not just AIPAC, it's not even just the organized Jewish community, which is very right-wing and tends to be farther to the right than the community at large. It's also any number of individuals who do feel something for Israel, and they feel sympathetic, and they help in whichever way they can, whether they have a job in the media or a job wherever they are. They have a little bit of money, they contribute. So it's an entire group effort, even if it's only 30% of the community, or 40%, 10%, whatever. They're very powerful, whether we like to admit it or not. And that is something that Chomsky is very strongly opposed to, the recognition of this fact. As a young man, he was a fervent Zionist, and he recognizes it. He admits it, even a kibbutznik for a couple of years, if I remember correctly, in the 50s.
Yeah.
He claims he's not in favor of a Jewish state in Palestine, but on the other hand, everything that he actually does, he talks a good game. I mean, he does criticize Israel in fundamental ways. That's good for him. But when it comes to the BDS, he's very ambivalent about it. Certainly when it comes to the academic part of it, he's against it. When it comes to his two-state solution, he's fervently in favor, even though he claims not to be. He basically explains white man's burden, that the Palestinians who do want this don't know what's good for them, that he knows better than the Palestinians themselves. How do you explain this kind of attitude coming from such a brilliant individual who otherwise is quite progressive and even radical on so many issues?
Yeah, I think that's one of the reasons we decided to have this conversation in a book, because I admire him. He was in many ways a guide, a moral guide, an ideological guide, not just to me, to my generation. And yes, there was a creeping disappointment about some of his position on Palestine, and I thought the book at least helped to clarify some of them, and I think it was important to understand, I think, his position. I think there are two sort of conflicting, probably, impacts here. One is with a genuine concern about the power of American imperialism. He really thinks that we might be looking at the tail of the dog instead of the dog if we credit so much power to the Israeli lobby and we forget the basic objectives of American capitalism. I mean, he will tell you how people who are 5% of the world hold 25, if not more, percent of the natural resources and so on. You know, all these amazing statistics about how America needs, in many ways, economically and ecologically, to control the world to keep its standard of living. I think that's why he wants to contextualize it a bit wider. And that's the part I can identify it. Where I think there is a problem is what you referred to. I think, although he's not a classical case of what we call in America PEOPS, progressive,
except on Palestine.
I think that, like so many of his generation who went through a Zionist period in their life, went through some anxieties as Jews and so on, they, almost in a subconscious way, they are afraid to let go of Zionism. I can understand it also because he didn't live here throughout these last 67 years. He didn't see, he didn't see the disease, how it really works. He sort of read about it more than saw it. And then he hoped that there's a better version of it. If you remember in the book, he talks about the need to see the varieties of Zionism, and I don't see the varieties of Zionism from the point of view of the native. So I think that you're right. It's something that you notice it in many other European intellectuals, that on any other issue, you would totally identify with them, and somehow this exceptionalism about Israel creeps in, sometimes hidden, sometimes very clear, sometimes in a very ambivalent way, and then it's covered by kind of general comments like Noam says there, well, basically I'm against states altogether, you know.
Right.
Because I don't know, it's just, I'm not a psychologist, but I, having done the journey myself, I know what you have to liberate yourself from. And it's not easy.
Yeah, there's a lot of fear. I mean, people are generally still fearful from what happened in the past to a lot of Jewish communities.
Exactly. It's the insurance company.
And the
I call it the insurance company.
Exactly. So it's hard to completely...
Maybe Israel is still an insurance company, but your insurance agent is such a lunatic. I would say, look for another insurance agent. How can anybody sell Israel as an insurance? But yeah, I think you're right. I think at the very, very basic, there's a fear. I sometimes think that the fact that from very early age I lived with Palestinians, I know the language, I speak the language, I shared so many things as friends, intimate friends, really cured me from this fear. You probably need through experience to go through it, you know. So I'm a great believer in the educational system here that we are building under the radar of the Israeli educational system and Arab Jewish from kindergarten level. I really think this is something that has a potential of, A, rehumanizing the Palestinians in the eyes of the next generation of Jews, but also dealing with these basic fears.
You do mention in the book somewhere that this fears is conflated or compounded by real racism, and it's hard to tell where one stops and the other begins. In the Israeli and pro-Israeli imaginary, a lot of the fear is self-constructed. This crazy Arab on the other side, who, can I really trust the Arabs?
And it's a product of indoctrination and manipulation that has been working for 100 years. Layer on layer. I mean, people here are exposed to this intoxication from cradle to the grave. You are exposed to it in overdoses. And I think American Jews were also exposed to this a lot. And sometimes maybe it's difficult to totally clean your body from this intoxication, from this venom.
And finally, as the last question, thanks very much for taking so much time this time, Ilan. Last question is, when these books come out, these brilliant books that you've been producing.
I
that we've been following, you know, we can't wait for the next one.
They will come out very soon. I mean, I have to also to have some space between books. I think that's one of the reasons to delay some of the books. We do hope next year that we will see two books that I'm really happy about. One would be the comparison between South Africa and Israel. The other one is really, I've written it now for 20 years. You will see when the book comes out why it took so long. But it was really trying to explain the history of the occupation of the West Bank and the Gaza Strip as part of the general context of ethnic cleansing. Mm-hmm. And it was not so much a matter of accumulating new evidence, although this is part of, a major part of the book is exposing the Israeli decision-making between 1963 and 1968. It's a very important period. But it was really finding the most persuasive way, which I thought was very important to the wider public, to explain why they were misled and taken by the nose with all this talk about the peace process, the two-state solution, how it was really an organic part of what we talked about, of a shield that was meant to cover up for the continued ethnic cleansing of Palestine.
How are these books that we praise so much and are are so important to establishing the history and spreading some truth. How are these books received, not on in the mainstream, that's not my question, but on the left? People like The Nation, Amy Goodman, Democracy Now, and all that.
It's an excellent question, and it's very interesting if you mentioned, Democracy Now or The Nation. These are the venues where people who stretch liberal Zionism to such an extent that if they would one day leave it, I don't want to be there to get it in the nose. It's like an elastic gum, you know?
Mm.
They have really succeeded in remaining loyal to a basic Zionist idea and yet being very, very liberal and open-minded. And I think what I'm doing is too much for them. I just pinch the balloon. And I say, guys, I'm sorry, you can't. And I know if they really mean well. They somehow believe that there could be a Jewish state and it could be liberal, it could be democratic. The Palestinians would be happy with that, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
And they are jugglers of words and ideas. They are squares of circles, amazing. And they're good people. I really love them. I'm not saying it cynically. I know them so well. Really, some of them I know personally. But I think it's time for them to understand it's painful. That what we have to do what I did. And it's not nice. I'm telling you, this is not nice to get out of the tribe.
Yeah, it's not
get
fun.
Get out of the warm embrace of the ideology. It's not a nice feeling.
Ilan Pappe is the author of several books on Israel, Palestine, and the history of Zionism, including his latest on Palestine, co-authored with Professor Noam Chomsky. This is an encore presentation of Voices of the Middle East and North Africa. From Pacifica Radio, this is Voices of the Middle East and North Africa.
And that's it for us this week. Voices of the Middle East and North Africa is produced at KPFA Studios in Berkeley.
To get in touch, you can call us at 510-848-6767, extension 632. Email vomekpfa@yahoo.com. Connect with us on our Facebook at Voices of the Middle East and North Africa, or follow us on Vomina Radio. Please join us next time for another edition of Voices of the Middle East and North Africa.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical. Coming up next,
CUC Radio.
CUC Radio. Time of Useful Consciousness. Our Common Future Under Climate Change. The Climate Deception Dossiers, Internal Fossil Fuel Industry Memos, and Decades of Corporate Disinformation. In July 2015, the Union of Concerned Scientists published the Climate Deception Dossiers. After years of research, whistleblowing, and freedom of information requests, a truly sordid picture emerges of fossil fuel corporations internally admitting that climate change is real, while at the same time spending millions of dollars to buy scientists who say that climate change is a hoax. These bought-off scientists and politicians make statements such as, "The sun makes things warmer, not humans or CO2, and anyway, CO2 is good for you and agriculture." The deception dossiers report the theft of letterheads of organizations such as the NAACP and the American Association of University Women. The Union of Concerned Scientists website shows copies of some of these forged letters. They were mailed to members of Congress claiming to be from nonprofits that advocate for the well-being of women, minorities, children, seniors, and veterans. They were urging defeat of legislation to protect the climate or undermining efforts at international climate treaties. The deception dossiers show how millions of dollars are still being used on advertising campaigns to spread misinformation and to fund efforts of organizations such as ALEC, the American Legislative Exchange Council. ALEC's money for climate campaigns comes from Chevron, ExxonMobil, Peabody Energy, and Shell. Much of ALEC's lobbying has focused on dismantling, at the state level, policies that have proven effective in reducing carbon pollution and accelerating the transition to clean energy. Prominent among the climate deception organizations is the Heartland Institute. They are openly facing off against the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, the IPCC. They created their own organization in 2013. It is the Non-Governmental Panel on Climate Change, the NIPCC. The Heartland's most recent salvo was an attack on Pope Francis and his appeal in the encyclical to halt climate change, when on April 28, 2015, the Vatican held a one-day climate summit, the Heartland protested that Pope Francis was receiving one-sided alarmist views. They sent a delegation to Rome, and Heartland Institute President Joseph Bast said, quote, "Humans are not causing a climate crisis on God's green earth. In fact, they are fulfilling their biblical duty to protect and use it for the benefit of humanity. We are bringing the Vatican a message of truth. The science is not settled. And global warming is not a crisis," end quote. Heartland did not want Pope Francis to, quote, "make the mistake of putting his enormous moral authority behind junk science." The outcome of the publication of Pope Francis' encyclical and the meetings held at the Vatican was remarkable. Maybe for the first time, the ethical and moral questions were being raised. What is the obligation of scientists to speak out about their findings? And what is the responsibility of those scientists and politicians who allow themselves to be bought and sold for the financial benefit of a corporation and their own? The encyclical also pointed with great urgency to one important question: are some of these processes of disintegration, such as the melting of Arctic and Antarctic ice and inland glaciers, so far advanced that they cannot be halted? And more scientists and even politicians are saying that we urgently need a timeline by which our economy will get off fossil fuels to stop the melting before it becomes irreversible. Some say this effort needs to lead to fundamental changes in the next 10 to 15 years.
We should not disagree when scientists tell us that we have a window of opportunity, 10 or 15 years, to turn this thing around.
Bernie Sanders, sticking out his neck on yet one more hot issue. And what's the role of the media in all this? This is a TUC radio special presenting the media that the Heartland Institute employs to convey their message. This one on Fox News, debunking Obama and Hillary Clinton.
The Earth may or may not be heating up. But there's no debate that the fight over man-made climate change certainly is. Despite repeated proclamations that science comes down on one particular side, it turns out many scientists do not agree. Correspondent Doug McElway reports tonight on the deepening divide over an issue that is part science and part politics.
But the debate is settled. Climate change is a fact.
A torrent of new data is poking very large holes in what the president has called the scientific consensus about global warming.
The dirty little secret is that we're now at 17 years and 8 months of no global warming. Their models have failed year in and year out.
Backed by thousands of peer-reviewed papers, a study released today by the non-governmental International Panel on Climate Change contrasts starkly with the recently released UN report that finds severe impacts from global warming. The new report finds that warming from greenhouse gases will be so small as to be indiscernible from natural variability. The impact of modestly rising CO2 levels on plants, animals, and humans has been mostly positive, and the cost of trying to limit emissions vastly exceeds the benefits. The report may only heighten debate over climate change, where both sides are armed with their own opinions and their own facts.
Climate change is a national security problem, not just an environmental problem.
And all of the predictions of the scientists are not just being met, they're being exceeded.
Skeptics believe those statements are demonstrably false. They point to observable data, not computer modeling, to prove their point.
Carbon dioxide has not caused weather to become more extreme, and it is not causing polar ice and sea ice to melt. It's not causing sea level rise to accelerate.
All of which is leading congressional doubters to further question EPA regulations.
The sheer number of proposed rulemakings coupled with the cost of compliance with the vast array of regulations already on the books and what at times are the unreasonable consequences of their enforcement is very, very frustrating.
Climate change skeptic Senator Jim Inhofe of Oklahoma introduced legislation just last week that would tackle the administration's regulatory end run around Congress. It would prevent the EPA from issuing any final rule until it conducts an economic analysis as required under the Clean Air Act. Brad?
Doug, thank you.
This is an audio clip from Fox News, posted on the website of the Heartland Institute. Contrasting this with a press release of August 24, 2015, by James Hansen and Makiko Sato, stating that, quote, "It is clear that 2015 will be the warmest year in the period of instrumental measurements, as an ongoing El Niño adds to warming trend. We can already predict that the 2015 global temperature will exceed the prior warmest year of 2014 by an unusually wide margin." Back to Fox News.
House Republicans asked the Obama administration to send its best climate change people to a hearing today up on Capitol Hill. Only 2 of 13 agency chiefs showed, and what they heard goes very much against conventional wisdom about the causes and effects of climate change. Correspondent Doug McElway tonight with Change in the Air.
A peer-reviewed climate change study released today finds the threat of man-made global warming to be greatly exaggerated and that it, quote, is not dangerous.
The big issue in the global warming debate is how large is the human impact on climate? And this report shows that it's very small, that natural variability, the variability that's caused by natural cycles of the sun and other factors, way outweigh anything that the human impact could have.
The report precedes the expected release later this month by the United Nations report on climate change. Leaked drafts show surface temperature increases have been statistically insignificant for the last 15 years, and that sea ice is increasing, not decreasing. Armed with these new findings, House Energy Committee Republicans today grilled administration officials about the economic consequences of the president's climate action plan.
So I would ask either one of you, what are the special plans in the president's action plan to help address these people who are losing their jobs? jobs because of these policies?
I'm not familiar with the details of those plans, but I am familiar from reading the Climate Action Plan that the President sees this as both a challenge as well as an economic opportunity.
The Energy Secretary told panelists that warming is on a hiatus and will resume.
Again, the evidence is overwhelming and the science is clear. The threat from climate change is real and urgent, and the basic science behind climate change is simple. Carbon dioxide makes the Earth warmer, and we are emitting more and more of it into the atmosphere.
So tell us, when is it that it's going to rise again? This is a question that I think not only me as a scientist, I think even all the layperson ought to begin to ask that question.
No increase in violent weather, no increase in hurricanes, all of this, and somehow we're still supposed to believe the models. Models that they picked because they supported their political interests, not because they represented good science.
Many recent storms, fires, and droughts have been blamed on climate change, but today's report finds a historical record of similar disasters long before man-made global warming was in anybody's lexicon. Brett?
Doug, thank you.
A Fox News clip posted on the Heartland Institute website. The climate deception dossiers published by the Union of Concerned Scientists in July 2015 come at a crucial moment. Even though they're losing in power to banks and financial institutions, fossil fuel corporations are still among the 50 richest companies, and the dossier tells us how that money is being spent. In the climate deception research papers by the Union of Concerned Scientists and other nonprofits are seven dossiers, collections containing some 85 internal company and trade association documents. They have either been leaked to the public, come to light through lawsuits, or been disclosed through Freedom of Information Act requests. These dossiers offer the most complete collection available to date. The UCS researchers write, as the scientific evidence concerning climate change became ever more clear, some of the world's largest carbon producers, including BP, Chevron, ConocoPhillips, ExxonMobil, Peabody Energy, and Shell, developed or participated in campaigns to deliberately sow confusion and block policies designed to reduce the heat-trapping emissions that cause global warming. The letters, memos, and reports in the dossiers show that company executives have known for at least two decades that their products, coal, oil, and natural gas, cause harm to people and the climate, but still chose to actively deceive the public and deny this harm. With documents made public as recently as 2015, the evidence is clear that a campaign of deception about global warming continues to the present. Taken together, these documents build a case for why these companies must stop sowing doubt and blocking progress and must be held accountable for their share of responsibility for global warming and the damages already underway. That's from the introduction to the recently released climate deception dossiers assembled by the Union of Concerned Scientists. From their own research, the UCS reiterated what is known and proven about climate change. Rising sea levels, longer and more damaging wildfire seasons, costly and growing health impacts, heavier precipitation and more extreme flooding, more frequent and intense heat waves. Here is how Fox News deals with these issues, and the Heartland Institute proudly posts this clip on their website.
Now to an unconventional challenge to the conventional wisdom about global warming. Correspondent Mike Tobin tells us about a new report questioning the severity and the dangers of climate change.
The
The UN-backed Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change recently concluded that the man-made impact on the environment will cause increased frequency and duration of storms, wildfires in North America, drought, decreased food production, and the spread of disease. Now a panel of scientists assembled to examine alternatives, the non-governmental International Panel on Climate Change concludes it's not that bad. NIPSI says there is more carbon in the air, but any change in temperature is within the range of what happens naturally. The human impact is small, and plants need carbon dioxide.
I think rising carbon dioxide levels and warmer temperatures have been shown to actually improve agricultural productivity. Billions of people are being fed today who would not have been fed.
Findings of the NIPSI panel are being published by the conservative Heartland Foundation. Leaders there say mainstream scientists are subject to both peer and financial pressure to reach the conclusion that human impact on the climate will be widespread and consequential.
Ethical standards have been lowered, peer review has been corrupted, and we can't trust what appears in our most prestigious journals anymore.
Those scientists agreeing with the notion that cars and industry are driving the temperature up and the planet to crisis attack the credibility of NIPSI scientists.
That's not really an assessment of scientists. Mostly that's a bunch of old retired guys that got together and wrote a report for the Heartland Institute it's basically full of misinformation.
Heartland says the NIPSI findings have been subject to extensive peer review. Contrary to what their critics say, the big public rollout is tomorrow in D.C. Shannon?
We'll be watching. Mike, thank you.
Climate scientists have documented that global warming is happening and that fossil fuel emissions are the primary cause. Now, a key question becomes, what responsibility do the major fossil fuel companies hold for these damaging impacts? When internal documents revealed earlier this year that ExxonMobil and other fossil fuel interests were secretly funding the scientific work of the supposedly independent aerospace engineer Wei Hawk Willie Soon, the news didn't come as a surprise. Back in 2007, a Union of Concerned Scientists report identified Willie Soon as one of a dozen scientists affiliated with more than 40 ExxonMobil-funded think tanks that then constituted the backbone of the climate change denier PR machine. Willie Soon, whose scientifically discredited papers claim the sun is responsible for global warming, produced work for at least five of these ExxonMobil-backed groups, including the Heartland Institute. But the latest cache of documents obtained by Greenpeace and the Climate Investigation Center through a Freedom of Information request lays bare a wealth of detail that was not available 8 years ago. Among other things, they show that Willie Soon received his funding exclusively from fossil fuel interests, including ExxonMobil, coal utility Southern Company, and billionaire industrialist Charles Koch. Soon described his scientific work and congressional testimony as deliverables to his funders, and some of his contracts specifically dictated that the Harvard Smithsonian Center for Astrophysics, where Soon works, not disclose the names of his benefactors. Here's Willie Soon's explanation of the effect of rising CO2 levels.
This is Willie Soon speaking. In a simple language, I think one should use the analogy of putting salt in your soup. Probably that the first few drops of salt that you take, you make the soup, salty. But then if you keep dropping salt, obviously the taste will be just completely bland. I mean, that's basically what we're trying to explain about this impact of CO2, which means if you keep adding more CO2, the effect of it will get diminishingly smaller and smaller. This is actually a very well-known physical effect that I believe that especially the realists, some of us scientists who really care about scientific evidence, often really apply this concept and this physical evidence to what we study in terms of how CO2 can affect the climate system, whereas the IPCC scientists and their reports and their models, I mean, seems to really ignore a lot of these points and effects. And one can see that effects actually very clearly from the kind of what we call future scenario that is offered in the IPCC reports. They are very fond of actually having the CO2 rise, increase basically from pre-industrial level of some order of basically 300 parts per million. By the way, 300 parts per million sounded very scary, but then in actual percentage term, it's actually 0.03%. So please keep that in mind. And then from then, IPCC will offer a range of future scenario. Some of that could actually go up to basically 450 parts per million, it's still 0.045%. Some of them, they go as high as 850 parts per million or even 1,000 parts per million. These are the scenario that I would have to say that even if one works very hard in digging all the ground from the earth and try to release all this carbon and burn it, that one would not be able to reach, get the atmosphere to reach that height of a level. So it's quite a bit of a stretch.
This audio comes from the podcast page of the Heartland Institute. And this is how the work of Willie Soon played itself out in the media. Also posted on the website of the Heartland Institute is the most eloquent of climate change deniers, Rush Limbaugh.
Evidence now leans against global warming resulting from human-related greenhouse gas emissions. According to the study's authors, these are 50 international scientists. We got a consensus here, folks. We have our own little consensus. 50 international scientists. And according to them, the hypothesis of human-caused global warming comes up short not merely of full scientific certainty, but of reasonable certainty or even plausibility. The weight of evidence now leans heavily against the theory of man-made global warming. Of course it does. We simply don't have that kind of power. Even if we were all diabolical and hated the Earth, even if we wanted to melt the Arctic Ocean short of a nuclear detonation, we couldn't do it, and even then we might have trouble. We just don't have this power that the left assigns to us. The science is now documented to be a hoax. Cryosphere is not melting at an enhanced rate. Sea level rise is not accelerating. No systematic changes have been documented in evaporation or rainfall, in the magnitude or intensity of extreme meteorological events, and an increased release of methane into the atmosphere from permafrost or sub-seabed gas hydrates is unlikely. The authors also note that forward projections of solar cyclicity imply the next few decades may be marked by global cooling rather than warming. What? These scientists actually factor the sun into all of this? Why, who knew? Yes, global cooling despite continuing CO2 emissions. And these guys, these 50, warn against using imperfect climate models to advocate for a one-size-fits-all climate policy. This paper was released, produced by the Heartland Institute. And as I mentioned yesterday, they have to do this because the left puts forth science to document their politics. Because that's all global warming ever has been. Man-made global warming, nothing but a political issue. An opportunity for the left to advance its agenda, bigger government, higher taxes, less freedom, all of that. More control over your life because you're responsible for it. You have to be reined in. You have to be controlled. Left to your natural instincts, you'll destroy everything. The Democrats, they know best. They're going to put rules and laws and taxes into place that will control your natural destructiveness. And they backed it all up with their science models. Well, the science models are hoax. But the scientists who don't believe this have to then come up with their own science. They just can't stand up and say these guys are wrong. And so more and more of the climate deniers have been documenting their refutation scientifically, all for the UN's IPCC and whatever open-mindedness they might find at the United Nations and in the media.
Rush Limbaugh, posted on the website of the Heartland Institute, a conservative think tank. Their mission is to promote free market solutions to social and economic problems. They deal with climate change, healthcare, education, and other issues. Heartlands is proud of their enormous reach into media, policymaking, and education. Their report for 2014 says, "We appeared in print and on television or radio 577 times. The paid circulation of newspapers and magazines carrying our commentaries or reporting on our work was 69.1 million. This radio program was based on the climate deception dossiers published in July 2015 by the Union of Concerned Scientists. There's a link to the text of the dossiers on TUC Radio's website. Find it at www.tucradio.org. The Union of Concerned Scientists was founded in 1969 by scientists and students at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. That year, the Vietnam War was at its height, and Cleveland's heavily polluted Cuyahoga River had caught fire. Appalled at how the U.S. government was misusing science, the USC founders called for scientific research to be directed away from military technologies and toward solving pressing environmental and social problems. You can hear this program again for free on TUC Radio's website, www.tucradio.org. Look at the newest programs or the podcast page. While you're there, you can subscribe to weekly free podcasts. Downloads are free, and we appreciate any size donation to keep TUC Radio on the air. Our email address is tuc@tucradio.org. My name is Maria Gilardi. Thank you for listening.
Welcome back to Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox. I'm your host, Cindy Sheehan. Today I'm going to chat with journalist, author, activist, analyst, Paul Street. And I'll let Paul tell you a little bit more about himself. So stay tuned and we'll be right back with Paul Street. Paul Street, welcome to Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox.
Thank you very much, Cindy. Glad to be here.
Well, it's really nice to have you on. I've admired your work for quite a while, and I'm glad to finally have you on the soapbox. But
thank you.
Before we get into, you know, what the interview is about, tell my listeners a little bit about yourself.
Oh, gee. Well, I taught history for years. I had a doctorate in it. Then I was what was sort of called a Marxist historian. Taught in the adjunct market for, gosh, seems like forever. Finally got out of that and into contemporary policy stuff, research, worked in that for years. I was a research director at a Black civil rights organization in Chicago for many years. And then when Bush ordered the invasion of Iraq after 9/11, I really started upping my presence as a contemporary political writer and an online writer. And particularly I started at Zenit, when the Obama phenomena emerged, I had a ground zero front row seat for the real Obama, as opposed to the fake progressive national brand Obama, because I was from Chicago. I was from Obama's neighborhood, and I actually dealt with Obama. But I started writing a lot of stuff about the Obama phenomena and started getting picked up at Black Agenda Report. Ended up writing books about the Obama phenomena and what a deception it was. And, I'm very eclectic across topic, but I work a lot with Dr. Martin Luther King's, what he called the triple evils that are interrelated.
Right.
The connection between racism, capitalism, and imperialism. And of course, a whole bunch of other evils as well. And lately, in the last, few years, I've become very big on the climate issue. I think I'm somewhat belated with that. And I branched out to Counterpunch and Truth Out and just all kinds of places. So, I don't know. That's a thumbnail.
Well, thank you, Paul. The reason that I contacted you to be on the show is because there was this, when you talk about the deception of Obama, let's make this clear.
Sure.
We're not talking about him being born in Kenya or anything like that. I mean, many people, since Obama's been president, they have called us things like, well, me for sure, things like teabagger, what are you now, Cindy, a Republican, blah, blah, blah.
Right.
But we're actually valid criticism from the left.
Right, yeah. No, when I say the Obama deception, that's right. I'm not talking about his birth certificate. I will say this, however, actually being from the south side of Chicago, I grew up in the neighborhood that Obama claims to be from. I will say I used to get very irritated at how many times Obama would refer to himself as being, this skinny guy with big ears with a strange name from the south side of Chicago. I know very well that Barack grew up in Honolulu, and went to a very privileged elite chief school there. I will throw a territorial thing in there. I actually grew up in the neighborhood that Obama claims to be from. But yeah, right, exactly. The deception that we're talking about is that he was some sort of anti-war, social justice, left-leaning progressive, who wanted to fight the corporations, and everything about in progressive change for working people and all of that. And as I said, I knew Obama from early on. I knew the Illinois and Chicago Obama phenomenon or the national one. And I knew very well that you don't ride up in Mayor Daley's Chicago and Rod Blagojevich's Illinois. He's being some kind of a leftist. And in fact, he had a whole different history in Illinois and Chicago that I knew very well. It's very conservative, both working with Republicans. Had nothing to do with all these hopes. All these hokey, changey, leftist delusions that so many liberals and leftists were projecting out upon him that had nothing absolutely whatsoever to do with his real legacy. And so, a lot of the early writing I did, along with the writing that Glenn Ford and Bruce Dixon were doing at Black Agenda Report, some of the stuff that the late Alexander Coburn was doing at Counterpunch, we pretty much tried to warn people about this illusion, about this branding, about this false projection, and pretty much predicted the entire trajectory of the Obama administration. And now you hear liberals, now I live in Iowa City, and campus sounds like this, they're disappointed and surprised at how right-wing Obama's been. But of course now they're going to redeem themselves and the Democratic Party, I guess, by feeling the burn of the nominally socialist Scandinavia fan Bernie Sanders.
Well, that's a great segue to the actual topic of the interview, I think I'm calling this show Don't Get Burned Again, BERNED again. Pardon me?
That's good. I like that.
Yeah.
That's interesting, yeah.
But there's and that has so many, layers to it. First of all, Bernie Sanders, like Obama, isn't the candidate or person that like you call and Jeffrey St. Clair calls him, the Sandernistas, project onto him. So I just recently wrote an article for Counterpunch, and I thought it would be great to go over the bullet points.
Sure.
about the ride on schedule, the bullet points about it. But before we go on the bullet points about your most recent article, tell my listeners about like how he is, you say nominally a socialist, but also nominally an independent, because he votes with the Democratic Party more than some Democrats do.
Right, yeah. Well, you know, he actually was explicitly asked recently in an interview, when he met Bernie, he said, well, he doesn't actually say socialism. That's the funny thing.
Right.
I've been to a number of Bernie events, because, you know, I'm in the middle of the ground zero of all this presidential stuff since I'm in Iowa, so I've seen a couple of Bernie things. I've heard him say socialism once. And when I see him interviewed, you know, he doesn't exactly run from the label, but when he's asked by it, by George Stephanopoulos or by more recently Ezra Klein of the Washington Post, he just kind of in this kind of vague kind of way refers to Scandinavia. He says we ought to be more like them. And of course they have their social democratic things over there that I think a lot of us in the United States would probably like to have, including single payer insurance and a much better safety net and so on and so forth. But he never says that. So what he really means, he's really sort of a populist.
Right.
And maybe a little bit of sort of vaguely a social democrat. So, you know, I don't necessarily know what people mean when they say, I mean, socialism to me has always meant people's control, and particularly working people's control and workers' control of the economy and of society, you know, and bottom-up, rank-and-file, you know, power to the people. You don't hear anything about that from him. So that's kind of why I say, along with Glenn Ford, nominal socialist. As for being a Democrat, that's all. I mean, as for being an independent, that's also been very nominal and very sort of deceptive for a very long time. I mean, that goes all the way back really to the beginning of his career in the U.S. Congress. He was technically an independent mayor of, you know, kind of liberal progressive Burlington, Vermont in the 80s. I mean, that's true. But when he ran for Congress, technically as an independent, in 88, he split the vote with a Democrat and a Republican won, and he took the lesson of that from that point on to really be a de facto Democrat, and he cut a deal with the Vermont Democratic Party where he would be technically independent because that kept his supporters in Burlington happy. But he would block any serious efforts at third party formation. And as it evolved over time, the Democrats agreed to put him on the ballot line every time he ran for the House. And then this continued on when 2000, when he ran for the U.S. Senate. He would be on the ballot line as a Democrat in the primary. He would win. And then he would technically repudiate his Democratic nomination and claim to be a Democrat. But while he was in the House, and particularly since he's been in the Senate, he's also cut a deal with the Democratic leadership, whereby he votes with them. He votes with them on pretty much all procedural matters, and he votes with them pretty much on all policy matters. In fact, that's absolutely right. He's had a voting record more with the Democratic Party than some left Democrats. And if he does those things, and he almost never breaks from form on that, he gets to have de facto Democratic Party seniority on committees, just as if he were a lifelong, full-on, full-blown Democrat. So, you know, that's a Democrat, and of course he's been very supportive of Democratic wars. When he likes wars, when they're ordered by Democratic presidents. So when Clinton bombed Serbia, he was all gung-ho for that and fought his own anti-war protesters in Vermont. He was for Obama's bombing of Libya. It's just the horrors of what Israel has done to Gaza and to Palestine. He's been on their side along with the right-wing Democrats. So, you know, independence is a very deceptive thing. And you feel it. And the thing is, in this presidential thing, I've heard him do this in Iowa. He kind of makes this big storyline about how he supposedly agonized
wanted to give up his independent status. And he finally decided, since you can't run as a third party, because then you just become a spoiler, you know, like a rat. Evil Ralph Mayer, or I guess evil Bill Stein. And he just agonizingly had to go back into the Democratic Party. That's very, very deceptive. He has been a de facto Democrat for 25 years.
Well, I mean, I have a whole, you know, opposition to the entire system. I call it the electoral industrial complex in the first place. But when Bernie decided to become a member of the Democratic Party to run, that's when, you know, I didn't, I just kind of said, oh, well, then forget about it. I'm not even, besides the fact that I know that he's not as great as everybody claims that he has been as a senator, as a congressperson, when he changed to the, when he decided to run as a Democrat, that just like stopped it for me. That was just like, I was at that point.
Well, you know, Cindy, I'm kind of with, like you in that regard, in the sense that, I mean, I do my protest voting every 4 years. I vote for the Ralph, I vote for the Jill Stein. I've always done this, go back forever. I used to vote for the Socialist Workers Party.
Right.
In I remember one of my earliest things as a young man being involved in politics was Barry Commoner in 1980. I remember campaigning. But, you know, I don't personally make that big a deal out of electoral politics.
Right.
Because of the nature of our electoral system, which to me is, it's not just the money, it's not just the media. I mean, it's constitutionally set up in such a way as to block serious efforts at popular sovereignty, particularly at viable third and fourth parties. And I've always agreed with something that Howard Zinn used to say, which is that, you know, it's not really about who's sitting in the White House. That's not the critical thing. It's not who's sitting in the streets. You know, it's about who's exercising pressure day to day, you know, beneath and beyond what Noam Chomsky has called these personalized, quadrennial extravaganzas. You know, whatever their outcome, which frankly we don't have a lot of impact on what their outcome is going to be. That has a lot more to do with money and media. And you know, and the variable we do have some control is how I think is how we focus our energies. And, you know, presidential elections, so like the Democratic Party, presidential elections again and again and again. I'm not a young man anymore, so I've seen this for a while. I've been the graveyard of social movements, of the real politics that matters. You know, the grassroots movement building, which is difficult, everyday, painstaking work. And I think people like the easy politics.
Right.
Or I don't vote for somebody. What did that take? I mean, it takes 2 minutes. I mean, that sounds slow. But actually, for me, the early voting at the Iowa City Public Library, I've done it in 3 minutes. You know, I won't do my process over Jill Sainte in 3 minutes, and I'm out of there. And it's a much more relevant question is, what did I do the day before that and the day after that? I'm here in Iowa. They're trying to build a pipeline carrying fracked gas through 17 counties from North Dakota down to the Mississippi River. We've got a new drone war air base in Des Moines. We have some of the most polluted waterways and streams in North America because of big agriculture. I mean, I could go on with the issues. We have a horrible race disparity in our incarceration rate. And, you know, again and again, I see this quadrennial presidential candidate center freak show come into this state and hover over it for 6 months, 23, 27, 2011, 2015, and suck up all the political energy. And then you see very little left for an anti-war movement, and very little left for an environmental movement. So, you know, I tell people, if voting makes you feel good, you know, do it.
Right.
Whatever. I mean, they're going to do it. They're just, you can't stop them. People are into it. It's almost like an American religion. We've been raised to believe that this is how you affect change. And I can't stop it. But as I say, it makes you feel good, but please come back to the real day-to-day politics of, you know, pick your issue. I think we need to combine more of our diversity. I think that's the urgent task, to pull together our issues and have one big movement this year. You know, pick your issues or your issues
and stay with them and fight on them day to day after these candidates, because they will leave. The caucus will be over here in Iowa on January 3rd, and the reporters will go away, and the CNN trucks won't be down the block anymore, and we're going to have our real life and the real struggles we need to fight. We're fighting for a decent minimum wage right here at the county level in Iowa City, and it's a worthwhile struggle.
Well, you know, that brings up so much stuff to me, and thank you for, you know, articulating that. The only reason that I even, you know, I wrote a book called The Obama Files, Chronicles of an Award-Winning War Criminal, and it was like 500 pages. It was 500 pages of my articles since he was inaugurated, and I had to cut it back to 250 pages. And, you know, the only reason I focus on people like Obama and focus on people like Sanders is, like, what better way to expose the system than to expose people like this? And then, you know, just remember when Obama was running, and I was running for Congress at the time against Nancy Pelosi.
Sure.
And so when Obama was running, people would tell me, Cindy, you know, it's like what FDR said, we have to make him do it. And Obama would say, we have to make him do it. And then as soon as Obama was inaugurated, as soon as he started drone bombing the innocent people of Afghanistan and Pakistan, I said, where the hell are you guys? Oh, we, you know, give him a chance. Then it turned into give him a chance, Cindy.
Right. Yes. You know, I heard that was the line at The Nation, right, and other of the so-called left vanguard, really liberal democratic institutions, Israel van den Heuvel, is famous again and again. You know, apparently in the 30s, FDR did say that. Franklin Roosevelt said that.
Right.
And I think he may have meant it to labor leaders. You know, I've been looking for where Obama ever said that. And the best I could ever find, now make me do something progressive.
Okay.
I mean, first of all, there's a morality in that. Why do I have to make, if you're progressive, why do you make them make you do something? You would do it because you believed it. If you really, you know, if you really honored the statue of Martin Luther King Jr. that stands behind you in the Oval Office, Mr. President, you wouldn't require me
to be
opposed to what Israel's doing to the children in Gaza.
Right.
You know, but the closest I heard him, like I'm saying, is in Montclair, New Jersey, in 2007. He sort of said something that, like that, to a Palestinian activist. You know, so well, make me be decent on Israel.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, make me do it. When his administration started, there were people protesting for nationalization of the banks and breaking up the banks and protesting and going to the 1% of households in Connecticut and Manhattan. And he loaded up and pushing into there was all kinds of anger. There was public opinion data. And he was just loaded up in his administration with people from Wall Street and doing everything that Wall Street people wanted to do. And Rahm Emanuel, who at that time was his chief of staff, who's now the corporatist mayor of my dear old city of Chicago, used to go to weekly meetings with the so-called progressive movement in Washington and yell at them and curse at them and civil rights people and environmentalists and tell them to shut up and be quiet, basically cuss them out and say shut up. It wasn't exactly some of this administration that wanted to be pushed by progressives. It was telling progressives to shut up and lecturing them on the need to be quiet. And then when there was this remarkable moment in the late summer and fall of 2011, and you had this magnificent, rapid-fire populist movement called Occupy broke out from coast to coast, the Obama administration's Department of Homeland Security worked with Democratic Party mayors and city councils in hundreds of cities across this nation to physically to infiltrate, to spy on, and ultimately to physically dismantle that populist people's economic movement at the same time that they worked to steal the rhetoric of Occupy and use it against Mr. 1% Romney in the presidential election in 2012 on top of which I could tell you stories about the Obama administration and then the Rahm Emanuel administration's unbelievable military state police presence in Chicago in May of 2012 to crush people who were there to protest against NACO.
Right.
And originally GA. So, you know, make me do it, right. And then you're signing off on a police state that crushes people trying to press for progressive change.
Well, you know, I got arrested in front of the White House. I don't even know how many times when Bush was president. And I was wondering,
sure.
And then of course I followed him to Crawford, Texas, and got arrested there. So I was like starting to feel like he would be.
Well, you see, and that's very important, Cindy, because, you know, I wrote a book called Empire and Inequality in 2004. I was very politicized by Bush and by the invasion of Iraq. And, you know, and it's very important that you have that history, too, because when people tell you, when liberals accuse you of being a teabag or a right winger, you have to say to them, and I do this for myself, too, you don't have anything on me when it comes to fighting Bush and fighting the Republicans.
Right.
I mean, I wrote a bitter and acerbic book with my colleague, Tony DiMaggio, called Gresh and the Tea Party. I'm no illusion about the right wing. I'm not a fan of them at all. And I probably fought the right wing and the Republicans more energetic than any of the liberals. And in fact, part of my criticism of the Obama phenomenon and the Democratic Party, of which Sanders is part generally, you know, is precisely that they haven't done anything really to fight the right. And the weakness of what passes for liberal and progressive change right now is precisely what creates an opening for this hard proto-fascistic right wing to become as powerful. You know, it dawned on me when I was in Chicago at the time, we had these incredible demonstrations. I mean, the outpourings, I'll never forget them. Two nights in a row, we owned the outer drive in Chicago. We owned Michigan Avenue for two nights. And it finally dawned on me that half of us people, particularly the richer people, pouring out of the apartment buildings along the lake, weren't really there to protest imperialism or war as such. They were there to protest Bush. And that if it had been a President Al Gore who had invaded Iraq,
right,
or later a President Barack Obama, they would have sat on their hands and found a reason to be okay with it. You know, it's just something, it's just amazing how imperial policies that liberals hate, you know, when a kind of gruff Texas-speaking cowboy Republican white guy is doing them, but when they're supported by a slick-talking black liberal, supposedly liberal Democratic politician like Obama, or for that matter, a nominally socialist senator like Sanders, and you know, everything's fine.
I do want to talk about Sanders and his. He's already said that he will support the Democratic nominee, that Hillary Clinton is a good friend of his and he admires her. But I want to tell you a quick story about Obama before we get into that, because I can't believe we're almost out of time. So I got an email from the chairperson of the Progressive Democrats of America. And she told me, like, this was a personal email from her to me. She told me that she and Tikkun, which is Rabbi Michael Lerner's so-called progressive Jewish organization, were on a conference call with Barack Obama, the president of the United States. And this was just recently. And she said, Cindy, and this was all about the Iran thing, because, you know, they have this treaty with Iran about Iran not getting a nuclear weapon, even though Israel has hundreds and the United States has thousands. But anyway, the Republicans are going to try and derail it, I guess, that treaty, but they're out on their vacation right now, right? And so the chairman of the Progressive Democrats of America said, Cindy, Obama was begging us. He said, we need the anti-war movement out in the streets right now because, you know, this is a good time to attack the Republicans. And I told this person, I said, you have to be kidding me. I said, I was booked in Washington, D.C. in March. I got arrested trying to demand this war criminal. Obama is drenched in blood. Demand this war criminal end his wars. And this is when he started bombing Libya. I got arrested. I spent 60 hours in shackles. And then I got a stay-away order from the White House for 6 months. I told this person, you know, the peace movement has been demanding peace. And now he wants to use us as a political tool again. And you're going to fall for it?
Right. Yeah. No, it's very unfortunate, and this is where the PDA really, I mean, you know, the PDA supports something that even, you know, leftists are for, like domestic policy.
Right.
I mean, I'm you know, I'm for single-payer insurance. I really am. I'm for a great big green jobs program. I put those things that PDA people and Bernie Sanders said before. I think, you know, I think he may be sincere about single-payer. I think Bernie may be sincere about green, you know, green jobs program and infrastructure. I mean, but, you know, they go, this empire stuff, you know, and go, and you know, and so people like us, you and me, and others on the actual left, can't deal with all this imperial militarism. They say, "Well, he's not perfect," you know. We Russian candidates be perfect.
Right.
You guys don't get it.
Yeah.
You can't pay for the domestic social programs that you say you're for when you support this empire, which eats up 57% of federal discretionary spending. It's this great sucking chest wound that takes energy and skill and money and you know, away from what we need to do. And if you know all of Scandinavia, or if you're more like Scandinavia, well, guess what? Norway, Sweden, Finland, and what's the other country, Denmark, their defense budget is about 4% of their overall spending. And there's a reason for that. They invest to some extent. I mean, I don't romanticize those countries, but they live in real welfare states.
Right.
And we don't. And we don't because we have such a warfare state.
That's perfect. So to me, Sanders is an imperialist, and I can't ever support that. I can't support, I always say Gaza forever, Bernie for never. But this is the last question. You brought this up in your article, and when I send out the newsletter for this show, I'll link like many, many of your articles. But
oh, super! Thank you.
Is it reasonable or realistic for people, the Sandernisters, to think that someone like Bernie Sanders could actually push or pull someone like Hillary Clinton to the left?
Oh, no, no. Hillary has died in the wool corporatist. I mean, this goes way back. I mean, I people ought to read them. There was a nice article in the Harper's recently by Doug Henwood a while back, which really recounts the Clinton's history, which I think we need to be looking at right now. Going all the way back to Arkansas in the 1970s and the 1980s. I mean, the Clintons were pioneers of what became the Democratic Leadership Council. They were in the vanguard of moving the Democratic Party further away from labor, further away from civil rights, further away from peace, you know, Chris Hitchens wrote a wonderful book called No One Left to Lie To, and there's this wonderful section in it where he talks about Hillary just totally dismissing single payer when the healthcare debate arose during the first Clinton administration. I mean, here was the head of Physicians for a National Healthcare Plan from Harvard Medical School, David, I think it was Himmelstein.
Well, that's the soapbox for this week. As always, I hope you were informed and inspired.